A logo appears in bold slanting letters over a blue planet in space, Turner. Now, over a still image of covered wagons fording a wide river, a word appears, Overture. Logo of a thick-maned lion framed by a ring of film, Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer. Titles appear over a painting of an Indian on horseback, a stagecoach, and hulking bison. Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer and Cinerama present How the West Was Won. Starring Carol Baker as Eve Prescott, Lee J. Cobb as Marshal Lou Ramsey, Henry Fonda as Jethro Stewart, Carolyn Jones as Julie Rawlings, Carl Malden as Zebulon Prescott, Gregory Peck as Cleve Van Valen, George Pappard as Zeb Rawlings, Robert Preston as Roger Morgan, Debbie Reynolds as Lilith Prescott, James Stewart as Linus Rawlings, Eli Wallach as Charlie Gant, John Wayne as General William Tecumseh Sherman, Richard Widmark as Mike King, co-starring Bridget Baslin, Walter Brennan, and David Bryan, with Andy Devine, Raymond Massey, Agnes Moorhead, Henry Harry Morgan, Thelma Ritter, Mickey Shaughnessy, and Russ Tamblyn. Narrated by Spencer Tracy. This film is described for blind and visually impaired audiences by Descriptive Video Service at WGBH. Described by Paula Broussard and Carrie Danahy. Read by Miles Neff. Funded by the U.S. Department of Education. Music by Alfred Newman. Songs, How the West Was Won. Music by Alfred Newman. Lyrics by Ken Darby. Home in the Meadow. Lyrics by Sammy Kahn. Raise a Ruckus, Wait for the Hoedown, and What Was Your Name in the States? Lyrics adapted by Johnny Mercer. Folk singing by Dave Gard and the Whiskey Hill Singers. Scenes with the buffalo were photographed in Custer State Park, South Dakota. Certain other scenes were filmed in the Uncompahgre, Tonto, and Inyo National Forests. To the officials of the state of South Dakota, the United States Forest Service, and Bureau of Reclamation, we express deep appreciation. Directors of Photography, William H. Daniels, ASC, Milton Krasner, ASC, Charles Lang Jr., ASC, and Joseph Lachelle, ASC, in Metrocolor. Art Direction, George W. Davis, William Ferrari, and Addison Hare. Set Decoration, Henry Grace, Don Greenwood Jr., and Jack Mills. Color Consultant, Charles H. Hagedon. Film Editor, Harold F. Kress, ACE. Assistant Directors, George Marshall Jr., William McGarry, Robert Saunders, William Shanks, and Wingate Smith. Special Visual Effects, A. Arnold Gillespie and Robert R. Hogue, ASC. Costumes by Walter Plunkett. Copyright 1962. Music Coordinator, Robert Emmett Dolan. Written by James R. Webb. Supported by the series How the West Was Won, which appeared in Life magazine. Produced by Bernard Smith. The Civil War, directed by John Ford. The Railroad, directed by George Marshall. The Rivers, the Plains, the Outlaws, directed by Henry Hathaway. Now, in a blue sky filled with majestic billowy clouds, we drift high over ragged mountain peaks. Passing through the clouds over a craggy ridge, we see miles of steep, barren mountains stretching to the horizon.
This land has a name today and is marked on maps. But the names and the marks and the land all had to be won. Won from nature and from primitive man. 5 generations ago...
Now, a lone trapper on horseback leads a pack mule.
This land was known only as the West. Known only to a handful of white men. Lonely trappers wandering its vastness in search of beaver. They were known as mountain men.
He reaches an Indian village.
Men like Jim Bridger, Frenchy Sublette, Linus Rawlings. More Indian than the Indians in all but blood. They held to no law but their own. Drifted free as the clouds, settled nowhere, kept forever on the move. Their moccasined feet and unshod horses leaving no trace on the land.
He nods to an Indian brave in a feathered headdress.
Like the Indians with whom they were at peace, they wanted nothing beyond what they found.
Now he rows a long canoe.
The mountains, the forests, the harsh country were as unchanging to them as the stars, and just as unyielding.
He glides across a glassy lake.
Far behind the mountains, beyond the rolling plains, they had left the people of the East, people who were restless in another way, the kind who'd look at a mountain and see a watershed, look at a forest and see lumber from
a frontier town, a banner reads, Opens the West, the Erie Canal.
Their faces and their instincts had been turned to the West ever since Plymouth Rock and Jamestown. The trapper's road was the trail of a wolf or the bend of a canyon, but for whole families, chafing to follow the sun, there had to be broader ways. There were no roads into the wilderness, only rivers. And they flowed in the wrong direction, north or south. Or else they stopped at the Alleghenies. Until one day, a new river took source in the mind of a man named DeWitt Clinton. He conceived of a river that would go west. And in the way Americans have of acting out their dreams, it came to be. The Erie Canal left the Hudson above Albany and carried clear across to the Great Lakes. People who yearned for virgin land and a new life now had a highway to take them, and they moved along.
Pride of Utica now loading! All aboard for the Pride of Utica! The Ramsey family! Peter Smith! The Stoker family! All eight of them! All aboard for the Pride of Utica!
A family waits on a bench, surrounded by suitcases.
The levees help the reason you're heading west.
Partly. Only partly. Mostly our trouble east was rocks. I had me a farm where some years I'd raise 100 bushels of rocks to the acre.
Now, Zebulun, you hadn't ought to lie to the man like that.
Wife, I'm a God-fearing soul, and I tell the truth as I see it.
The grizzle-bearded Zeb wears a wide-brimmed black hat.
I blast out the furrows with gunpowder. And then one morning, I hauled the bucket up from out of the well, and so help me, the bucket was full of rocks. Rocks! I just stood there right still, trying not to blaspheme. And I said to myself, you've got a son that's ailing, you've got a 20-year-old daughter what won't take to herself a husband. There she sits over there, mooning as usual.
Pa.
And you've got another daughter who just don't seem quite right in the head. Lilith!
A blonde teen gazes off dreamily. She wears a straw hat and a peach frock.
I'll remind you, sir. I'm still standing there holding a bucket full of rocks and staring into a bleak old age. So I made me a vow right then and there. I said, if I can find a man with $500 who likes rocks, then there's going to be another fool owning this farm. Well, sir, the Lord provided such a man, and here I am.
He ain't told you one word of truth, Mr. Harvey. We had the best farm in the township.
Yeah, Rockville Township. It was Stone County.
No, it was not. It was his itching foot that brought us here.
Three young men approach the Scottish fellow.
Look, these are my laddies. Angus, Brutus, and Colin.
How do you do?
I think they're already acquainted with your daughters.
Be they single?
Aye, single so far.
Well, this Illinois country's beginning to sound better to me.
Lilith, here. Strike up a little tune for these handsome lads.
Oh, I ain't no mood, Paul.
Lilith, there's a time for coaxing. This ain't the time.
He passes a squeeze box to Lilith. She sits next to Eve and starts to play.
All right. Captain Bold in Halifax, who lived in country quarters, betrayed a maid who hanged herself one morning in her garters.
Lilith! Now, you know better than to sing a song like that.
What ones do you know?
We know Yankee Doodle.
Yankee Doodle?
Their mother's dead. They haven't had much learning in the social graces since we left Scotland.
All right, give them a home in the meadow.
Away, away, come away with me.
Eve, come on, you two.
Where the grass grows wild and the winds are
free. Come on, join
me. Away, away, come away with me. And I'll make you a home in the meadow.
Come on.
Zeb swings his arms brashly as he sings. His wife scolds him, tapping his knee.
Flying Arrow! All aboard for the Flying Arrow! The Prescott family!
Here we
be!
Come on!
Alec Harvey and three sons!
Zeb, the Scotsman, and their families all gather their things. Later on the canal.
James and
Harvey! New mule and her name is Sal.
15 miles on the Erie Canal.
She's a mighty slow worker for a good old pal.
15 miles on the Erie Canal. We hauled some barges in our day, filled with people, coal and hay.
On the flat barge, Mrs. Prescott pulls out a basket of food. Later, in a forest, a man guides mules, which haul 2 30-foot logs toward the bank of a river.
But the canal was only the first step toward the promised land. The next steps were longer and harder. Those who could raise the fare went by steamboat to the end of the line. Others found a cheaper way to head for Ohio, Illinois, and the open spaces beyond.
By the water, Zeb and 6 other workers lashed the long logs together, fashioning a large raft. At a nearby campsite, Lilith and Eve prepare food. Eve steps away from stirring a pot. Holding a book, she sits by her sister.
Lilith, listen to this. Theirs was a poignant parting in the forest. The handsome young backwoodsman carved 2 hearts on a tree trunk. Then from 10 paces hurled a knife at the junction of the 2 hearts.
Junction? What's that?
Well, that's where the 2 hearts meet. Now listen. His marksmanship was uncanny. 3 times he hurled the knife on target. That was for luck, he said the first time. That was for love, deep divine love, he said the second. And the 3rd time, that was a prayer, a plea for love undying. Isn't that beautiful?
I reckon, if anybody ever talks like that.
Well, it's the sentiments, not the talk.
There ain't no sense to you, Eve. You want to be a farm wife, but you don't want to marry a farmer.
Well, neither do you.
Of course not. I don't want to have nothing to do with farms. I want silk dresses and fine carriages and a man to smell good. What I want's back east, not west. But I'll get there yet. You watch.
You don't know what you want yet. It's the man that counts, not where he lives.
Later, on the riverbank, a crowd watches as Zeb brandishes an axe near the finished raft.
Ready now, huh?
Zeb slices a rope holding the raft on shore. The raft slides down 2 log rails and splashes down into the water. Now on board, Eve and Lilith operate 1 10-foot oar as a teenage boy rows the other. In unison, they heave ho and guide the raft downstream. A second raft follows. Later at a campsite.
Daddy! Something coming up river. Hostile engines, I expect.
Zeb and Rebecca follow the boy toward the riverbank. Eve springs to her feet and follows. Angus, Colin, and Brutus join them, and the 2 families watch from the sandy bank as a long canoe approaches. Rebecca clutches her husband's arm as she watches the boat glide closer with its lone passenger.
The river pirates, Evan?
Don't know. They say no honest man travels this river at night.
I can only see 1 man, Paul.
I hear that's a favorite pirate trick. They hide in the bottom of the boat till they're ready to jump you. Get my gun, Colin.
All right, Paul.
The long canoe filled with animal pelts pulls up alongside the anchored raft. It's the trapper. Zeb watches him warily.
Just come in slow and easy, stranger. And keep your hands where we can see them.
The middle-aged trapper takes in the guarded faces of the crowd on shore. Eve gazes at the man, transfixed. With a wry grin, the trapper slowly climbs out of the canoe onto the muddy bank. His buckskin shirt and pants are fringed.
Name's Linus Rollins. I'm hungrier than sin and real peaceable life.
What have you got in the craft?
I have beaver pelts. I said beaver pelts.
I never had a chance to see a beaver pelt, Mr. Rollins.
Eve steps forward.
Well, in that case, ma'am, I'll show you one. There you are.
Oh, that's real soft.
Lilith watches from a distance.
Pelt,
now, my apologies, sir. We was afeard you might be a pirate.
I ain't no pirate.
Come on, let's have supper and get acquainted.
Eve hands Linus the pelt.
No. That's yours. Keep that.
Linus follows Zeb and the family. Eve stares after him, dreamy-eyed. She holds the pelt close to her chest and softly strokes the fur. Lilith, leaning against a tree, watches the trapper pass, then eyes Eve smugly.
Well, you sure set your cap in a hurry. Is he the backwoodsman you've been waiting for? More than likely, he's got a wife and 6 kids waiting for him.
Eve blows across the fur at her sister. later at the campsite.
When I was single, when dressed up so fine.
Linus wolfs down a plate of food as the others watch.
Now I am married, go ragged all the time.
Thank you, ma'am. That's right tasty.
You've only ate four plates. I was beginning to think you didn't like it.
Well, it don't pay to eat too much on an empty stomach, ma'am.
How come you to be traveling so late at night?
Well, I'm kind of anxious to get to Pittsburgh. I ain't seen a city for a long time. I aim to whoop it up a little.
Well, now, we've never seen a mountain man before. Tell me, them Rocky Mountains as high as they say?
Oh, no, I just don't rightly know. I never clumb one.
Zeb and the others watch eagerly.
Well, now, you know, that just ain't exactly true. Jim Bridger and me, we started up one of them little bitty Rocky Mountain foothills, you know. And then, one day we see this fella, and he has a great big pair of white wings and a harp in his hand. And I said to Jim, I don't like the way that fella's looking at us. And Jim said he didn't care too much for it, neither. So we both skedaddled down out of there, and to this day, I ain't never had a good look at the Rocky Mountains.
Lilith stares innocently over her squeeze box.
Well, I remember one
Zebulon,
time...
Zebulon, one liar at a time is enough.
Well, then, reckon it's about bedtime. Got to get an early start in the morning. We'll be expecting you for breakfast, Mr. Rollins.
Oh, well, that's mighty hospitable, Mr. Prescott, but sometimes I wake up and get the urge to move. I might be long gone by sunup, but I want to thank you. I want to thank all of you. Good night.
Good night.
Night.
Strange fellas, these mountain men.
Yeah, kind of like a wisp of smoke.
Linus sets off toward his canoe, then halts, glimpsing something near the riverbank. Eve arranges bushy leaf branches under a brightly striped saddle blanket. Hat in hand, Linus ambles over to her.
By golly, that looks like my blanket.
It is.
Well, then I'm a mite confused, ma'am. Whose bed would it be?
Yours.
I ain't had a soft bed like that since last time I come east. Why'd you do it?
Ain't polite to ask a girl why she done something for a man.
No, well, I reckon my manners ain't much at that, huh? Anyway, sure, thank you. Good night, ma'am.
Eve faces Linus. A length of her golden hair trails past her shoulder to her bosom.
Are them Injun girls pretty?
Well, now, I reckon that all depends on just how long a man has gone without seeing one.
How long has it been since you've seen a white girl?
I ain't quite sure why you ask that.
How pretty do I look to you?
Ma'am, ain't you just being a little bit forward?
Well, you're headed upriver and I'm headed down. Just no time to get these questions answered.
You dead sure you want them answered?
Yes.
Linus pulls Eve close. He gives her a deep kiss, which she receives, gripping his back with her hand. They slowly pull out of their embrace, and Eve smiles in a daze at Linus.
Ma'am, it seems like you've been kissed before.
Oh, I've never been kissed permanent before.
By golly, you sure use surprising words. I never heard permanent mixed up with a thing like a kiss before.
I can still feel that kiss. You?
You said something before that we hadn't ought to forget. I'm heading upstream and you're headed downstream.
Lovers have parted before and come together again.
Ma'am.
Eve,
I'm a sinful man. Deep, dark, sinful. I'm on my way to Pittsburgh to be sinful again. Likely I'll stay drunk for a month. I won't even remember the fancy gals I dally with or the men I carve up just out of pure cussedness any more than I remember you.
Linus, I'm asking you. Can you still feel that kiss?
Eve. Eve, you make me feel like a man standing on a narrow ledge, coming face to face with a grizzly bear. There just ain't no ignoring the situation.
He takes her waist and pulls her into a stronger kiss. Their bodies press tightly together as Eve stands on tiptoe. Morning. Zeb walks down to the riverbank and crouches at the water's edge with a washing pan and towel. He looks up. Linus's canoe is gone. Zeb scans up and down the river. He races back to the campsite.
Eve! Where is he? Anyways, you're here. I thought you'd gone with him.
Gone?
Yes, gone. I knowed you were setting with him. But I kept telling myself, well, at least she's looking at a man. Even a wisp of smoke like that is better than...
Eve's head droops, and she picks at a tree.
You crying? Crying for him? Now, what does that mean? Now, tell me what that means.
Nothing, Pa.
What time did you come to bed?
Lilith interjects.
It was early, Pa.
It wasn't. It was late.
Daughter, I'm only going to ask you once. Is there anything for your Ma and Pa to worry about?
No, Pa, there ain't.
Zeb and Rebecca watch Eve walk off sadly. Lilith trails after her sister, following her to the empty bed of leaves.
He'll be back. I'll see him again.
But you expected to see him this morning. You know you did.
I don't care. I'll see him again. Look.
A tree trunk bears Eve's and Linus's initials carved inside of two intersecting hearts.
You got a grown man to do that?
I did. Just like in the book.
Did you get him to say them crazy words?
I told you before, it ain't the words, it's the sentiment.
You mean, he didn't even giggle nor nothing at such foolishness?
He said it was a real solemn occasion. Like shooting the rapids without a paddle.
No matter what he said, he did it just to get rid of you so as he could clear out. You know that's so. And you're lucky he did. Do you want to live like a squaw all your life?
Go on, say anything you like. But I'll see him again. I know I will. And he ain't got a wife and six kids. He ain't got a wife at all yet.
Now, on the river, Linus paddles against the muddy current. He sights a crude banner. Fine old liquor sold here. Colonel Jeb Hawkins, proprietor. Liquor is spelled L-I-K-K-E-R.
Yeah! Someone coming up river!
A lookout at the water's edge calls to a long-haired man high up on the riverbank beside a cave. Inside the cave, wall-mounted torches light rustic tables laden with jugs. The long-haired man peers in.
Customer!
Several dirty men snap to, and a brunette woman joins the long-haired man at the cave entrance. He points at Linus's canoe.
Trapper, seems like. See how that cover bellies up? Could be furs.
The woman smiles. Linus scrambles up the steep, rocky bank to the cave entrance. He carries a colorful Indian sack decorated with fringe. The woman coyly faces him as he approaches.
Thirsty, mister?
Dryer and a grasshopper and a hot griddle.
Inside, a portly man at a crude wooden counter shakes Linus's hand.
Well, welcome to our little inn, sir. My name is Jeb Hawkins, late colonel of the Alabama militia. Where you bound for, sir?
Pittsburgh.
Pittsburgh? Where?
Looks like he's got a whole canoe first, Pop. Sure enough, mountain man.
Indeed. One of our brave explorers going to extend our domain to the first shores of the Pacific. Well, nothing but the finest for you, sir. Whiskey?
Right.
He grabs a jug.
No pepper or rattlesnake heads in this. Nothing but the pure grain and the sweet kiss of them all.
Well, you'll never mind the cop. I'll just take the jug.
Oh. Real mountain man, huh? I trust you'll toast our noble banner here, sir.
Sure will.
He points to a U.S. flag on the wall. Linus puts his finger in the jug's handle, slings the jug onto his elbow, and tips it to his lips. He pats the fat container affectionately as he swills the brew. The young brunette stands close to him. Linus lowers the jug, then swallows, grinning.
Golly, you're right. That's real sipping liquor.
Pa, him being a trapper, you suppose he might know what that varmint is we got?
Well, say now, he might. Yes, sir, he just might. Sir, we caught us a cave-dwelling critter that no man in these parts has ever seen before. And you know it'd be right satisfying for having you tell us what it is.
Well, I don't know too much about cave-dwelling varmints.
Just yonder. Take your jug.
Well, I...
Jeb hands Linus a torch.
I don't know.
As the woman leads him off, Linus lights the way, and they walk deeper into the cave. Linus glances back warily at Jeb before rounding a corner. In a dark passage, the woman moves in front and faces Linus. She backs away slowly, then stops and points toward the shadows.
It's right over here.
She leads him further into the dark cavern. As Linus looks around for the animal, she walks closer and presses her chest into his side.
You know any sweet-talking gals in Pittsburgh?
Nope. There ain't one yet.
Well, Pop and I are hoping we'll vacation there.
I'll be at the Duquesne house if it ain't burnt down. Hey there, now, you pretty girl, are you sure you got a varmint in here?
She steps over to a large pit.
You hear him?
Huh?
He breathes loud and fierce. We keep him in this hole just yonder.
You keep him in there?
Linus peers into the blackness.
Gotta look a little closer.
As Linus leans over, the torchlight gleams on the pit's dark walls. The woman creeps behind him, pulls out a dagger, and stabs him. He drops the torch as she shoves him into the pit. She stares downward, her dagger glinting. Jeb waits at the entrance to the passage.
Well, he sees the varmint, Paul.
Well done, daughter.
I ain't so sure. It was hard muscle, and I could feel the blade just kind of skitter along his ribs.
Oh, you just need more practice, that's all. It's a pity you ain't got the neck your ma had. Lord rest his soul. All right, men. Lay on, men. Come on. We got more fish to fry. Down to the island.
Jeb's men pack hurriedly. Outside, Linus surfaces in a pool near another cave. As the bandits pack their belongings into three boats, including Linus's canoe, the injured trapper wades through the water. Linus crawls up the bank and spots the busy gang at the crude dock below. Out of breath, he lies behind a boulder overlooking the shore. Linus takes a handkerchief out of his deerskin satchel and presses it to his chest. Jeb and his men shove off, heading down the river. Later, downstream, two rafts drift on the water. At the riverbank, a pair of Jeb's bandits work on a small dock beside a new banner, which reads, Bedloe's Provisions and Trading. The men throw a heavy rock through the bottom of Linus's canoe, and river water quickly fills it. As the rafts float closer, the long-haired bandit nudges his partner.
Tell Pa them settlers' rafts are coming.
As the man strides off, the bandit releases the tie line of Linus's canoe. The boat sinks. The Prescott's raft approaches. Lilith and Eve stand up front, holding thick ropes. Later, both families browse under a crude tent. Pots, jugs, and cups hang from the canopy's rafters. Lilith eyes a bottle of perfume.
Can't I have this toilet water, Pa? Genuine Parisian accent, it says.
How much is it?
It's only 15 cents.
15 cents, put it back.
You're right, sir, absolutely right. He saved the penny and the dollars will grow. Like you growed many a dollar that way, ain't you?
Well, Mr. Bedloe, all my life I've been striving to avoid becoming a millionaire, and I think I've succeeded right well. Still, I've got a little put away in the sock, and it's going to stay right there.
Well, now, them's my sentiments, exactly. Now, you, sir, you look like a man of property. Now, if I was to bet, I'd say you was worth, say, $1,000? Pretty close to the mark?
Well, close, maybe.
Jeb motions to his brunette daughter, who nods and eyes Lilith. Meanwhile, on the open river, Linus lies belly down on a large tree branch, paddling along. As he approaches the riverbank, he grabs a skinny branch overhanging the water and steadies himself. Rubbing his tired face, he spots the rafts belonging to Eve's family and their companions and slides off his floating branch. He swims closer. A man rummages through the settler's gear. Linus dives under, then surfaces next to one raft. As the bearded robber steps from one raft to the other, Linus grabs the man's ankle and pulls him into the water. The two wrestle. Linus stabs the man twice. Back at the trading post, the brunette ducks behind a tent flap, and Jeb and the long-haired bandit aim pistols at the families.
Colin, how much powder we got left?
Don't be a bit, man! There's women and children here. You gents wouldn't want us to have to start shooting now, would you?
Armed bandits surround them.
Being good cheer, folks. Why, it's in our noble tradition that we conquer the wilderness with nothing but our bare hands and stout hearts.
Linus sneaks up behind the robbers.
You can build new rafts and sally forth in the spirit of your forefathers.
Why, you pious old scoundrel. I'll see you burn.
Jeb snatches a money pouch from Zeb, then takes the man's watch. Hidden nearby, Linus grabs an axe stuck in a fallen tree.
Americans can't be whipped.
He throws it. It lodges in a robber's back.
I know he come back. It's him.
Now, Linus throws a knife into the long-haired man's chest. The crowd brawls. Zeb throws Jeb into shelves of merchandise. Lilith spots the brunette leaving with a pouch of coins. She grabs the pouch and whacks the brunette across the face with it. As Eve, her mother, and her little brother crouch in a corner, Zeb and Linus each fend off two bandits. Now, a bandit beating a settler with a lit torch gets shot. Jeb shoots the gunman. The shot tears out through his back. Now, Linus cracks a chair across Jeb's face. As the man goes down, the trapper spots a stack of gunpowder kegs. He hurls one into a campfire. The blast sends several men flying and ignites a tree that crashes down. Two men dive out of the way. Later, the settlers throw the last of Jeb's things on the burning remains of the tent. Zeb clenches his hands together.
Now, let us pray.
The settlers kneel.
O Lord, we thank thee for our salvation.
Linus awkwardly bows his head.
Commit the souls of our dead to thy gentle keeping. We pray for a speedy recovery of our wounded.
Lilith and Eve kneel by their injured teenage brother.
And now another matter. O Lord, without consulting with thee, we have sent thy way some souls whose evil ways passeth all understanding.
He nervously wrings his hands.
We ask thee humbly to receive them, whether you want them or not. Amen.
Later, the settlers take the wounded teenager to the raft on a stretcher. Smoke rises from the charred campsite. As Linus pulls his damaged canoe onto the bank, Eve approaches. She wears the beaver pelt tied around her shoulders like a small cape. Linus sees her, then gestures to the hole in his canoe.
Oh, it'll be a job. I guess I can patch her up good enough to get to Pittsburgh.
Linus.
Now, Eve, let's just not talk any more about it.
Linus, I'm telling you, you don't know your own mind.
Well, maybe so, maybe not. I ain't saying that you haven't been on my mind some. I ain't saying that. But I still went to see the varmint with that pirate girl. I'll always be going to see the varmint, Eve. I just ain't cut out to be a farmer or a husband.
Linus, I ain't never bringing up the subject again, whether ever I see you or not.
No, it's for the best. I wish you Godspeed, Eve. And I ain't said that to anybody for a long time.
Eve takes in Linus's gentle gaze uneasily, then turns and runs back to the raft. Later, on the river, the two rafts drift downstream. Dense foliage covers the banks, and the quickening current froths white around the large scattered boulders. Eve and Rebecca man the heavy 6-foot oars as Lilith dabs the head of her wounded brother under a tent. Zeb mans a rudder at the rear. His 8-year-old son stares at the turbulent river ahead, then stands up and points.
Wrong fork. Let's beach her on this side. RV! Rapids! Rapids ahead! Beach her!
The Prescott's raft dips and rises on the current.
Hurry, Eddie!
As the Scotsman's raft glides safely ashore, Zeb and his family struggle to control their raft.
Right! Paul, we're in the current!
Lilith tugs her 8-year-old brother to the tent.
Get inside, Zeke! No, I don't want...
Rebecca and Eve strain against the oars as the current churns around the raft. The raft pitches.
Lilith
rushes to help her mother handle the oar in the swift current. The rushing river carries the raft faster, and large boulders loom ahead. The raft broadsides a 3-foot boulder, and the current drags it past, undamaged. Eve and Lilith grimace as they work the oars.
Hold it steady!
The raft spins around. Laden with supplies, it turns in the water, out of control. Zeb yanks the rudder hard, and the raft narrowly misses a huge moss-covered rock. At the oars, Eve and Lilith grit their teeth, heaving to and fro. Water sprays up. The raft careens downstream and rams into a massive jutting rock. Pulled onward relentlessly, it remains intact. At the front, one of Zeb's daughters stumbles and knocks a crate overboard. With jutting boulders all around them, Zeb tries to navigate through the fast, low water. The raft circles to a stop, losing a crate and barrel. The raging water shoves the raft up on edge. More of the family's belongings drop off. At the last second, the raft straightens. The churning river surges faster. Jostled about, Lilith and Eve struggle to control one oar. The raft bucks again, and Lilith falls back into the opening of the wet tent. Rebecca climbs out and directs Lilith to the rear of the raft.
Go on, outside. I'll get it.
As Rebecca takes an oar, Lilith grabs the tent pole for balance. The raft rocks wildly. The tent collapses and Lilith falls overboard. The others drop to their knees as the current tosses the raft around.
Lilith!
Zeb shoves 2 lashed logs overboard. Lilith fights her way over to them and grabs hold. Zeb and Eve watch as she safely clears a fierce stretch of rolling rapids. Reaching calmer water, Lilith waves and starts to swim. On the raft, Zeb and his family stay low, balancing against the turbulence. Their clothes are soaking wet. Rebecca leans protectively over Zeke and her teenage son. As Zeb crawls to the front and eyes the rapids ahead, a wave drenches Rebecca and her sons. Zeb motions to them.
I know!
Up ahead, water rages down a bumpy slope of boulders. To her sons while Zeb huddles beside Eve. As the raft noses down the violent slope, water crashes over the settlers. The raft disappears into the seething foam. Now, downriver, Linus repairs his canoe and talks with passing trappers.
What happened?
They took the wrong fork of the river! And they went over the falls.
Did you happen to hear the name of the family?
Prescott, I think. Something like that.
Now, Eve, Lilith, and Angus solemnly dig a large grave in a forest clearing. With an axe, Alec carves a small cross at the base of a tree growing at the head of the pit. A bedraggled Lilith sets aside a pickaxe and goes to a shovel.
As soon as they're buried decent, I'm heading back east on the first boat that comes along. And if you were in your right mind... You would, too.
Lilith and Eve return to their digging. Eve stops and looks around. Sweat glistens on her chest above the scooped neck of her dirty blouse. Her eyes search the forest. Linus walks the river's edge. He glimpses Eve, and his gaze locks with hers. Eve runs to him, holding her skirts. The trapper steps toward her. Uniting, they wrap their arms tightly around each other.
Oh, Linus.
They share a long, tender embrace, then pull apart and look into each other's eyes. Linus looks past Eve to the others at the half-dug grave. He takes Eve's hand and leads her back over to them. Linus picks up Eve's shovel and tosses it aside. He helps Lilith out of the shallow grave, then grabs the pickaxe. The others watch solemnly as he swings it forcefully into the hard earth. Later.
Rock of ages, cleft for me. Let me hide myself in thee.
Now the settlers sing around the two dirt graves.
Let the water and the blood from thy side, a healing flood.
Linus stands silently beside Eve. Little Zeke covers his face and runs to a quilt spread out on the grass. Lilith sits facing him and cradles his head in her arms. As Alec and his sons go, Linus remains beside Eve. Eve blinks back tears.
Would you walk with me a piece, Eve?
She nods faintly, and they walk down a path, heads bowed. Sunlight gleams on the tranquil river and falls in patches on the shady path, lined with tall trees. Linus and Eve walk slowly toward the bank. They stop, and Eve stares up at the trapper, her cotton bodice stained with mud.
Eve, Eve, all the time I was paddling down here, I was thinking, if I found you alive, would you come to Pittsburgh with me, Eve?
Oh, Linus. I'm staying right here. I ain't moving a foot one way or the other.
Now, would you explain that a little?
My mom and pa, they wanted a farm in the West, and this is as far as they got. It seems to me this is where the Lord wanted the farm to be.
But your brother Sam, he bad hurt, and winter's
There's
coming.
There's no sense talking about it, Linus. I'm gonna do it.
Eve, you just ain't making much sense.
Half the people what come west don't make much sense, I reckon.
Linus searches her earnest face, then smiles peacefully.
All right. All right.
He takes her in his arms.
My golly, you're a strong-minded woman. I reckon I seen that varmint for the last time.
Holding her close, Linus gently kisses Eve's forehead. Near the riverbank, Lilith steps near a tree and sits by its large exposed roots. She lets out a despairing breath. Her tired gaze drifts toward the woods, and she bows her head. Lilith looks up at the river and sees a distant steamboat approaching. Her face brightens, and she walks purposefully over to the bank, her eyes fixed on the craft. Now, men clear brush as covered wagons pass by.
The westward course was no smoother than that of true love. Not only the hard hand of nature was against it, but the impediment of war. Trouble over land smoldered along the Mexican border. Not all Americans were for war, including Congressman Abe Lincoln of Illinois. But a war did break out. And in the end, vast new territories came into the Union, along with their rich Spanish names, Rio Grande, Santa Fe, Albuquerque, El Paso. And most glittering of all, California, named after a mythical island of pearls and gold in a 15th century novel. Here in 1848, at Sutter's Mill, a man found something he wasn't even looking for, at the bottom of a ditch. And the cry of his discovery was heard clear across the continent, in Boston, New York, Savannah, and across the oceans, in London, Paris, Berlin. But nowhere was the clamor of gold heard more eagerly than in St. Louis, the busiest fur trading center in the world, and the noisiest, bawdiest, most uppity town west of New York.
A poster reads, Star Dancing Troupe, songs by Lily Prescott. Inside, men in vests and women in skirts dance on stage. Two women do walkovers and land in splits. Another does a stomping pirouette. Four gentlemen watch from a table as they smoke cigars. On stage, two men lift a dancer who kicks her legs in a V. It's Lilith. She and the other dancers all partner off. Flips her partner and drags him by the arms. Now he stands and flips her. They land in a heap, and a decorated scrim descends. In the audience, one gentleman turns to his peers.
I say there's no more than three.
Six.
It's all that lace that fools you. I still say three.
Watch him. I hear Clee's an expert on petticoats. Anyway, you can never prove it.
Gentlemen, we're going to be late for that poker game.
Now look, I just stuck you for the most expensive dinner in St. Louis. And I don't
a
mind
man with a dark brow speaks up.
I'll lay you $100. It's no less than six.
How do you prove it?
Go backstage and find out.
If I go back and check with you.
Fair enough. Right.
The two men walk through the doorway to a dressing area. As they watch Lily towel off her arms, a worker points out Lily to a third man.
Second girl.
The stranger approaches as Lily takes off her outer skirt.
Miss Prescott?
Later.
It's rather important.
It's always important.
Lily removes one petticoat, and the dark-browed man holds up one finger.
Miss Prescott, please. I'm Hyland Seabury, attorney in the matter of Jonathan Brooks.
She removes a second petticoat.
He means nothing to you?
That old goat?
Well, you must have meant something to him, Miss Prescott.
Why?
You're included in his will.
Two more
come off. Of course, you have to make the trip to California to claim the bequest.
Well, now, I wouldn't go to California if John Jacob Astor left me San Francisco.
The dark-browed man holds up four fingers.
However, the yield for Mr. Brooks's property is not to be scorned.
Yield of what?
Gold, Miss Prescott. Gold.
Gold?
She drops her last petticoat.
You own a gold mine, Miss Prescott. It yielded $3,500 the very first week.
As the dark-browed gambler reaches into his pocket to pay up, Lily reads a report.
Well, that sweet old goat.
As Lily beams, the dark-browed man leers at her from the doorway, puffing on his cigar. Later, he enters a small room and stealthily reaches for a carpet bag. A curtain nearby slides open, and a cocky-faced gambler holds up his empty hand. The dark-browed man shifts nervously.
Well, this is an unexpected pleasure. Where's the money?
Money? Oh, yes. You're referring, of course, to our little agreement.
100 to start you off, and my share of the winnings.
Well, I'm somewhat embarrassed to report that the 100 no longer exists.
Two men stand beside their cocky leader.
That $100, I assure you, will turn out to be the best investment you have ever made. I have plans, gentlemen, beyond your wildest dreams. I'm going to earn you a piece of a gold mine.
Gold mine? You ain't going to earn nothing. You ain't going to be nothing. You ain't going to do nothing. Unless we get that $100 back by the morning.
Don't mean that. You're gonna kill off the golden goose?
Call her what you want, mister. We'll be waiting.
Coldly receiving a pat on the shoulder, the cocky gambler returns to his poker game, leaving the borrower's outstretched arms in midair. He yanks the curtain shut. The dark-browed man takes the carpet bag and packs some items. Now, at a crossroads, two signs read, Oregon Wagon Train, Jeb Smith Wagon Master, and California Wagon Train, Roger Ward Wagon Master.
Independence, Missouri was the jump-off point for emigrants from everywhere. Solid, God-fearing families bound for the farmlands of Oregon, and get-rich-quick adventurers racing for the gold of California.
A salesman demos a whip for Lily and a man.
Try it.
The man tries. He turns to Lily.
You got a wagon, I suppose?
I can get one.
And a team to pull it?
I can get everything I need.
You got a husband?
I'm single, Mr. Morgan.
No traveling companion?
No, I'm traveling alone.
Not on my wagon train. Alone and single. Brings out the deviltry in a man. Gets them all worked up and they're wild enough already.
I intend to keep to myself, Mr. Morgan.
Oh, a woman of your sort? One day you'd find yourself in trouble and there'd be all hell to pay just figuring out who.
She cracks a whip at him.
What did you say, Mr. Morgan?
He grabs her.
Well, now ain't you the feisty one. I like spirit in a woman. Hey, you got a pretty face under that powder, too. And a fine, sturdy body under them clothes, I wager.
He grips her tightly, then glances off.
There's a woman named Clegg, Aggie Clegg. Why don't you go see her?
He loosens his hold, rolls up his whip, then takes some coins and drops them in the vendor's hands as he leaves.
Thanks.
Lily winds up the whip in her hands and places it on a table. She smirks and walks off. Later, she faces a middle-aged woman in work clothes who repairs wheel spokes.
I told you no. I was hoping to make this trip with a husband. Nearly got one last week.
Look, I hear there's 40 men to every woman in California. Miss Clegg, I'd be willing to pay you.
I don't need money. I need a man. Any man.
Aggie looks up with interest as a man approaches. It's the dark-browed gambler from the music hall. He doffs his hat.
Morning, lady. Beautiful morning. Did you by any chance happen to be Miss Lily Prescott?
He addresses Aggie.
Not unless you got a big imagination.
Ah, then you must be the lady in question. Cleve Van Valen, Miss Prescott, at your service, at your every command from here to California.
Well, thank you. About whatever you're offering, I don't need.
Perhaps you don't understand.
Yes, I do. I know a ten horn when I see one.
Miss Prescott, I'm offering you an honest day's work for an honest day's pay.
Goodbye, Mr. Van Valen. Goodbye.
Well, it's been a pleasure to meet you, Miss Clegg. May I say, I have never seen a woman with more beautiful hair. What a prize catch it'll make. Hanging from the waist of an Indian. Beauty alone in the wilderness. And who's to protect you? No one. Not one person won't be looking after himself. Well?
He puts his hat back on and bows as he backs away.
Good day, ladies. Good day.
As they watch Van Valen leave, Aggie blinks dreamily.
Nobody ever said that to me before.
What?
That I had such beautiful hair. You know something? I got a hunch you're gonna draw men like fish to the bait. Maybe I can catch one of them while they swim by.
She shakes Lily's hand.
You got yourself a partner.
Thank you.
Now, on a dry, sweeping plain, men on horseback ride up to the leaders of a long wagon train. The covered wagons extend far off to distant hills. On one wagon, Lily holds the reins wearing a red prairie dress. Aggie sits beside her wearing canvas pants, a man's hat, and jacket. On his horse, Morgan reports down the line. He sees Lily and rides up alongside.
Hey, you're driving.
I was raised on a farm.
Lily smiles smugly as Morgan rides on. The wagon train dips and rises over the rolling plain. Open land stretches in all directions. 100 horses trot alongside the pioneers, herded by a mounted cowboy. Now, amid a dusty haze, the distant wagon train winds along the parched land. Huge white clouds hang low in the blue sky. The sun gleams on the herded horses as they trot along in the wind, their hoofs kicking up dust. Later, at the waterhole, the settlers are camped along the bank. At a table, Aggie cranks a grinder. Morgan rides up with two ducks.
Hey, Aggie! Can you use these?
Yes, sure. Thanks.
She takes the two birds as Morgan gazes off. Aggie looks too, then Lily. A man approaches on a mule. It's Van Valen. Lily rests a hand on her hip and gives an annoyed sigh. Van Valen doffs his hat.
Ladies.
Aggie brightens and primps her hair. Van Valen dismounts and faces Lily, who folds her arms defiantly.
At your service.
I thought we'd gotten rid of you.
Well, I just couldn't bear to think of you two making this trip without my help. Why, if I was to hear later on that something happened to you, I'd never forgive myself.
You came 100 miles alone?
Well, I have no way of counting the miles, Mr. Morgan. And I'll take your word for it.
Well, you got another 100, mister, going back.
I told you, when a wagon breaks down, I want men who can fix it, not bet how long it'll take.
You don't mean you turn me out, cast me adrift at the mercy of savage Indians?
You don't get moving, I'll cast you adrift.
I appeal to your sporting instincts, sir. I'm prepared to wager you that I stay with this train.
Well, you got a wager.
Wait a minute. The fact is, I hired this man. We'll put up his stake.
Dumbfounded, Morgan turns to Lily.
Is that right, Miss Prescott?
If Miss Clegg says so.
Van Valen puffs out his chest. He grins and tips his hat at Morgan, who turns and leaves. Lily and Aggie face the smiling newcomer.
Ma'am, I'll be forever grateful.
Aggie grins dreamy-eyed as Lily scowls.
Now, I'll unpack my gear.
As he walks back to his mule, Lily turns to Aggie.
Agatha, have you gone crazy?
He says he's a man wanting to do an honest day's work.
And he'll do it. I can promise you that.
Now, at a river crossing.
Are you men on that last wagon? Keep up that slack! Keep it up! Get that team moving! Keep them moving there!
Teams of horses line one side of a broad, shallow river.
Don't let those lines sag!
As men drive the horses, ropes stretching across the river pull taut and tow three rafts across. Each raft transports a covered wagon.
Keep those teams moving! Keep them moving! Don't let those lines sag! You and that little team, keep moving!
Later, on dry land, the wagons roll over a hill. At the base, Aggie's and Lily's wagon sit stuck in a patch of mud. As Lily cracks a whip at several harnessed teams hitched to the wagon, Aggie, Van Valen, and Morgan handle the reins. Behind them, the wagon's wheels are sunk halfway into the mud. As Lily yanks a pair of mules forward, two men push the wagon from behind. It rolls free. Lily wipes her muddy gloves on her hips. Her wet, soiled skirt hangs heavily. She spots Van Valen, chuckling at his own muddy gloves. Their eyes meet. They share a laugh. Night. Bluish moonlight shines on the camp. A lit lantern hangs on a post a few feet from a campfire. Nearby, Van Valen sits with a blanket around his waist as Lily mends his trousers.
I'm just overwhelmed by all this attention, Miss Prescott.
Lily smiles to herself as she sews. Van Valen slides closer to her, sitting at her side.
I want to confess. I have lied about why I wanted to work for you.
I know.
As Lily slides away, he moves closer.
The real reason is, of course, that I'm in love with you. No? It's the truth. From the first moment I saw you, I've known that I couldn't live without you.
Well, I'd hate to be the cause of your death, Mr. Van Valen.
I don't speak lightly, Miss Prescott. I'm prepared to assume the responsibilities of a faithful husband.
Oh, and are you ready to assume the responsibilities of my property, too, Mr. Van Valen?
Really? What kind of property?
Gold, Mr. Van Valen. Gold by the ton, from what I understand. Bright, yellow, shiny gold.
Why? I had no idea.
I'm sure you hadn't.
Miss Prescott, I really mean...
Here comes Agatha. If you must propose to somebody, I suggest you get on your knees to her. Besides, she has beautiful hair.
Aggie approaches carrying a bucket.
Look at them. Think they was getting ready to bury somebody. Ain't we worn down enough as it is?
Well, let's wake them up.
Lily strides to the center of the camp and throws out her arms.
Listen, everybody! Come on along, everybody come along. While that moon am shining bright, come on along and raise your voice in song. We gonna raise a ruckus tonight. Tain't no time to sit and brood. Raise a ruckus tonight. It's time to strike a lively mood. Raise a ruckus tonight. Go and get that old banjo. Raise a ruckus tonight. Just pat your foot and tap your toe. Raise a ruckus tonight. Do you hear me? Come on along.
She puts a man's hands together to clap.
while that moon am shining bright. Come along now, tune up that string.
She grabs a washboard and plays it.
We gonna get a ruckus tonight. Sing it out now!
Lily sits next to a man and bumps him in time to the music, then pulls him up to dance. Morgan watches and smiles.
Don't interrupt your friend.
Now, Lily partners up with Van Valen. As they turn in a bouncing high step, his blanket falls off, revealing his white long johns. He quickly covers up.
Yeah! That's the spirit! That's the way to feel! Yeah!
As Van Valen skedaddles, Lily grabs his blanket and pulls him back to dance. Captivated, Morgan lifts his hand in a weak wave as he watches Lily link arms with Van Valen. In the morning, Morgan brings freshly caught fish to Aggie and Lily's camp.
Aggie, for lunch.
Thanks. Nice mess of fish.
He pauses at a stream running through the camp and hangs the fish on a crossing log. Lily, carrying a bucket, sees him lingering.
What is it, Mr. Morgan?
Miss Prescott, I've been thinking.
Oh?
Wet or dry, you're the handsomest woman I ever did see. Spirit and a fine, sturdy body. It's a noble combination, Miss Prescott. Why, for you, childbearing had come as easy as rolling off a log.
Lily's eyes widen.
Well, I think I'd rather roll off a log, Mr. Morgan.
Ma'am, I'm telling you, you got the build for it. I want you for my wife. I've got a cattle ranch just below the Merced. I'll be settling down there fit and proper.
I'm sure you're very fit and proper, Mr. Morgan.
Well, then, you just couldn't do no better than marrying me. Why, we'd have ourselves a fine family in no time at all.
I believe that. I'm sorry, Mr. Morgan, but I can't accept your proposal.
Why not?
Well, a woman likes to hear something a little more inviting.
Well, ain't that what I've been doing, inviting you? Inviting you to share my life, Miss Prescott.
Lily shakes her head softly.
I'm sorry, Mr. Morgan.
Something else, ain't it? Must be something else nagging at you. Well, I don't aim to let it stop me, Miss Prescott. You can count on that.
What did he want?
Children.
Children? Well, I'll be... Why didn't he come shopping at the right store?
Lily throws Aggie a smile. Later, the wagon train moves across the plains. High snowy peaks loom in the distance. On a rocky pass, 20-foot boulders flank their path. From an overlook, four shirtless Indians sight dust stirring in the arid valley below. Mounted on palominos and spotted pintos, they hold long feathered spears. Dozens of Indians on horseback wait behind them. Below, the pioneers' numerous horses gallop past, sending up clouds of dust. In the back of one wagon, Van Valen plays cards with three men.
Look.
Well, now, gentlemen, are we pikers? I'm going to see, and I'm going to raise this fine pistol, London made, and loaded for bear.
I'll take part of that, man.
Morgan, riding past, overhears the game. He yanks Van Valen out by the collar, and the gambler tumbles to the ground.
I told you I wouldn't stand for you fleecing any...
Morgan's gaze fixes on the rocky hills.
Cheyenne. There's too many to stand and fight. We'll have to make a run for it.
You can't outrun them with his wagons.
The minute you get moving, cut your lead teams loose.
Have you gone crazy?
Go on, get moving, Red. Chances
rifle.
Are they want our stock more than they do us. Now, you're a gambler, ain't you? All right, let's get moving.
100 Indians gallop fiercely toward the wagon train, armed with spears and bows. Their horses' hindquarters are painted with tribal markings, and bright feathers are braided into their tails. Up ahead, the wagon train crosses their path. The spoked wheels churn up dusty clouds. As Morgan takes the lead, the Indians charge at full tilt, their faces painted with bright stripes. Now, on the front of Lily and Aggie's wagon, Van Valen leans out over the jostling reins.
I don't know how to unhook her.
As Aggie drives, Van Valen carefully watches a man on another speeding wagon. The man climbs out onto the long wooden shaft that attaches the harnessed horses and sets the front four animals loose. Van Valen tries. He leaps out behind the lead team and struggles with the leather straps. From the back of another wagon, three men crouch with rifles and shoot at the Indian pack. Two Indians fall from their mounts. Meanwhile, other Indians round up a team of the pioneer's horses. An Indian's arrow pierces a man's chest. He falls to the ground, a galloping horse trampling over him. Now, bolting horses pull a wagon through a narrow gap between two boulders. The wagon slams sideways, rolls, and breaks apart. The riflemen shoot again, and three leather-clad Indians topple off their horses. On Lily and Aggie's wagon, Van Valen still struggles to release the lead horses as an Indian rides up next to him. Aggie lashes her whip around the Indian's neck and yanks him off his horse. He clings to the whip, which drags him across the ground. Up front, Van Valen releases the two lead horses. Now, the wagon's rear wheel grinds into the back corner of another wagon, which careens down a rocky slope. The cargo bed flies off and rolls downhill, sending its passengers tumbling inside. Van Valen sees the accident. He climbs over one of the team horses and lands running on the ground. As he heads down the rocky slope, Lily gapes.
Please!
With a gunshot, Van Valen takes down an Indian and his horse. Getting up, the horse rolls over its rider's body. Now, at the overturned wagon, Van Valen drags out an injured passenger. A mounted Indian jumps the wreckage and throws a spear which just misses, piercing the dirt. Now, Lily's wagon jolts and she falls off. As Morgan approaches astride his steed, the horse flops onto its back. Morgan gets up.
Joe, pick me up!
He jumps onto the horse of a passing wagon, then rides toward Lily and pulls her up behind him. As the pioneers race on, the Cheyenne Indians slow to a trot behind them. They round up a dozen of the pioneers' horses and 20 of their longhorn cattle. Later, at twilight in the pioneers' camp, Aggie helps set a splint on a man's leg. Lily paces nearby, gripping a bucket. Aggie looks up at Lily, who glances anxiously at the darkening sky. She carries the bucket to a campfire and sets it down near a large steaming pot. Morgan approaches from behind.
We'll be moving at daybreak. I'll take a few men and see if we can find him. Give him a decent Christian burial.
Lily drops her head sadly. A watchman crouching with a rifle between two wagons sees a man approaching in the shadows.
Someone's coming! Someone's coming!
Lily and Aggie race over and see a man on horseback with a body draped over the saddle. As the bedraggled rider comes closer, Lily smiles. It's Van Valen. He lets the body slide off the horse, and several men rush over to fetch it. Exhausted, Van Valen passes out and falls off the horse. Lily's jaw drops and she runs to him. Morgan approaches and stops short as he sees Lily cradling Van Valen's head in her lap. His mouth tightens and he slowly backs away. Later, Van Valen and Lily stand outside a blacksmith's shop. A sign reads, "Rigs for Hire."
Well, I can let you have this rig for a dollar a day. I'll give you a good team.
Pick it up in the morning.
That'll be fine.
Could you tell me the way to the Brooks claim?
Oh, the claims are down by the river.
Which road should I take?
Only one road.
Along the river.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Lily smiles at Van Valen, clasps her hands together in the crook of his elbow, and pulls herself close to him. He smiles and shakes his head. Daytime, at a small rustic cabin, a grizzled prospector sits on the front porch.
Looking for a Mr. Huggins.
You found him.
Van Valen helps Lily onto the porch. She wears a fancy red dress and matching bonnet.
This is Miss Lilith Prescott.
I figured.
They told me you was a real looker. Yep, it's all here for you. Just the way Mr. Brooks faked it out. Must have had 20 men working on it.
Well, where are they now? Who's digging the gold?
Gold? I ain't never seen a better grade since I come here with Millie. It was just a pocket, though. The whole shebang. Nothing but a pocket. Oh, we cleared 4,200 before it played out. Now, about that 4,200, Mr. Brooks, he spent three for his heart give out. I put up 600 for a brass handle casket. I figure the rest you owe me for setting on your claim.
Lily looks at Huggins, then turns silently and walks away.
Oh, miss, I mean, that's only fair, ain't it? I mean, wouldn't you?
Van Valen follows Lily to the path where their wagon waits. Huggins sucks on his pipe, then scratches his neck with it.
Funny pair, all right.
Down at the river, two Chinese men pan for gold. Van Valen helps Lily up into the wagon, then climbs in. As Lily gazes attentively at him, Van Valen takes the reins, then looks downward, glowering. Nighttime. In town, a man beckons outside a tent.
How about you boys over here? Come and see the brand new attraction. It's exciting.
Inside, Lily sings in a sparkling pink leotard.
How do you want it for life? Because you left your poor wife when she caught you sniffing a cork. My friend, hey, what was your name in New York?
She pushes away a grabby man with her foot.
What was your name in the East? And how recently was your release? Are you riding the rails because you held up the males? Or was it the females you held, you beast? What was your name in the East?
Morgan watches from the tent entrance.
Oh, what was your name in the States? Though you've suffered the cruelest of fates. Way out here in the West, everybody's a yes. So line up and fill up your place, my friend, whoever you was in the States.
Lily bows to the crowd, then runs off stage. On a platform outside, another dancer limbers up and goes on. Lily retrieves her hat and sees Morgan enter through a drab curtain strung from a tree. She shifts on her feet, expressionless, then enters a covered wagon made up as a dressing room. As she sits at a mirror, Morgan scales the platform steps and walks over to her.
Miss Prescott?
Hello, Mr. Morgan. I'd invite you in, but it's a little cramped.
Morgan glances around and spots a small stool on the platform. He grabs it and sets it just inside the doorway. Sitting, he stares at Lily, then shakes his head.
This is no life for a fine woman like you.
Lily pauses from undoing her upswept hair.
I heard your mind was played out. But where's your fancy friend?
Leave? Last I heard, he was in Hangtown.
You mean that no good went off and left you?
Lily's gaze drops and she nods.
He went off and left me. But I don't agree that he's no good. Cleve is Cleve. That's all.
You're a perplexing woman, Miss Prescott. When a skunk needs killing, well, it ain't enough just to say a skunk's a skunk.
Mr. Morgan, all my life I've wanted to marry a rich husband. Can I blame Cleve for wanting to marry a rich wife? Both of us may have been born for the poorhouse, but we're not the kind to like it.
Morgan takes her hand.
Do you believe all this you've been saying, or is it just words? Now tell me the truth.
Truth is, Cleve and I couldn't live alone, just on love. Not for 5 minutes.
Then you've answered the question I've been asking for better than 2,000 miles. I got the biggest ranch you ever did see. You can't ride across it in a day. That land's gonna mean money sooner than you think. You want a rich husband. You're looking at him.
Lily folds her hands and fidgets under Morgan's earnest gaze.
I mean, the blessed thing you have to do, set mind the kids.
sorry. Not now. Not ever.
What a waste. Someone put together like you.
He rises to his feet. As he steps out, Aggie stands nearby, holding a basket.
Aggie?
Now a steamboat moves down a river, washed in lavender light.
Those who struck it rich wanted all the pleasures that money could buy, and there were plenty to sell to them. Even the Sacramento River boats took on luxury goods.
On board, Van Valen plays poker with four men. He puffs on a thin cigar as a man deals cards. The singing voice draws his gaze toward the next room. He puts down his cigar and takes his cards, then looks off, deep in thought.
I'll sit.
He listens intently.
Except you.
A card player stares at him.
Breton.
Van Valen throws down his hand and springs to his feet.
What's the matter with you?
He gathers his chips.
I'm checking out.
Checking out?
What's the matter with you?
Hopeful heart for the willing hand.
He enters a small auditorium where Lily sings, dressed in an elegant gown.
There's a wondrous land where I'll build you a home in the meadow.
Van Valen beams.
The stars, oh how bright they'll shine on a world the Lord must have helped design. The stars, oh how shine.
At a table, Aggie wears her own fancy gown. The ship's aging captain approaches in uniform. He points at the empty seat next to Aggie, and she nods. As he sits, she gazes at him girlishly.
For the hopeful heart, for the willing hand.
Now, Aggie primps her hair, grinning at the captain.
There's a wondrous land where I'll build home in the meadow.
Van Valen walks toward the stage as Lily steps down. She notices him and stops. As Lily starts to walk away, he rushes to her and holds her by the shoulders.
Lily, I got to talk to you.
He shoots a sidelong glance past his shoulder.
I found myself throwing in a winning hand. I just never thought I'd do that for any girl. Lily, how'd you like to hook up with a no-good gambler?
Lily grins joyfully, and they embrace.
And we're on our way. I got $1,200 right here.
What do we do? Open a gambling house?
No. A married man should spend his evenings at home.
Well, then we'll open a music hall in San Francisco.
No.
I can still sing and dance.
No. A married woman should spend her evenings at home.
We can't sit at home on $1,200 forever.
Have you seen San Francisco? It's ugly, and it's small, and it's full of fleas. And it burns down about every 5 minutes. But each time they keep on rebuilding it, a little bigger and better than before. It's alive and kicking, and nothing can stop it. And it makes you want to build something, too. Railroad. A steamship line. Something to help the baby grow.
Clean. On $1,200?
I think we could start out with a wagon or a rowboat. With the help of the devil. I'll bet we make it.
They embrace again and lock in a firm kiss. Outside, the steamboat glides along the river. The light from a few windows reflects on the dark water. Now, the painting of the horses and bison racing toward one another appears. Then, a yellow title, Intermission. Now, a still shot appears, showing horses and covered wagons at the bottom of a hill. A yellow title overlays it. Entr'acte. Modest office, a tall man in a black suit looks out a window. Behind a dark wood chair padded with black leather, a framed map of Illinois hangs on the wall. A quill pen on the desk juts from an inkwell. The man sits down, puts on his spectacles, and writes.
Young America was not only a union of East and West. There were North and South, too. And between them, the bonds were weakening. Mr. Lincoln, now retired from Congress and practicing law, realized that the South would fight to mold the new and uncommitted territories to its own image. Still 2 years from the presidency, he pleaded that the free West be allowed to remain free and warned of the hazards of a house divided against itself. But the South, seeing its power and influence wane, struggled against the inevitable in dozens of Western towns. And slowly, the bitter seeds of civil war took root.
Now, at night, in a frontier town, a gang of horsemen with whips and rifles disperses an assembly of townspeople. Daytime. A man drives a horse-drawn carriage up a sunny country lane lined with trees. In a yard by a log cabin, Eve looks up from stirring a large kettle. Nearby, a young man runs in from a plowed field and climbs over a split rail fence. A second young man glances over his shoulder and drops an armload of firewood on the ground. Eve steps forward.
Howdy, Miss Lovin!
Oh, Rosebud, who?
Hey, Mr. Peterson. What's that suit you got on?
Uniform, Mrs. Rollins. A uniform. Our militia company was sworn in and... I'm Corporal Peterson now, Ohio Volunteers. You won't be seeing me for a spell.
Hey, I got a letter for you from way out in California.
It must be from my sister Lilith.
Eve holds out her hands as Corporal Peterson unfolds the letter.
Dear Eve.
She grabs the letter out of his hands and reads it anxiously.
Mr. Peterson, could you wait a minute? Might want to answer this right away. Zeb, come on down here.
We was hoping Zeb might be going with us.
His pa went when the first bugle blew. Ain't one enough.
Zeb grins.
Back, Corporal.
Jeremiah, get Mr. Peterson some buttermilk.
Buttermilk.
Her younger son, Jeremiah, sportingly pants Peterson's leg and runs off. Zeb follows Eve to the house. She gently waves the letter.
From your Aunt Lilith. She says there ain't no war out in California, and they don't expect there be one. Business is brisk. There's many opportunities for an energetic young man. Let's talk of building a railroad east. Cleve has hopes of getting in on the ground floor. We would welcome Zeb if he wants to come.
Ma, did you write her about me?
Not exactly.
Now, did you?
Oh, you told her you didn't like farming any better than your pa did.
Ma, you got the wrong idea about this war. It ain't gonna be so bad, is it, Corporal? You know Pa's having the time of his life.
Ms. Rollins, I got it from the captain himself that we ain't gonna be gone no time at all.
Pa left it up to you whether I'd go or not. But you know what he really felt.
Ms. Rollins, there ain't much glory in tromping behind a plow.
Reckon there's no hurry in answering this letter. Thank you for waiting.
Zeb sits next to Eve on the front steps.
You mean I can go?
Oh, there'll be things to do.
She tucks the letter in her blouse.
Ma?
Gotta get your underwear washed. Your socks darned. They give you one of them suits, one of them uniforms.
I reckon.
Might not give you no shirts, though. Take that and off, I'll wash it for you. Got the others washed, they aren't ironed yet.
Mother, I...
Zeb averts his gaze.
Why'd you call me that? It's always been Ma before.
I don't know. All of a sudden, Ma didn't seem enough somehow.
Zeb looks down at his folded hands, his short sandy hair parted roughly to the side. Eve slowly gets up, then crouches down and hugs her son. clutching her dingy skirt, she heads inside. Zeb watches her go, then jumps up.
Yahoo! Hey, careful!
Zeb bolts over to the carriage and his excited brother, then stops and looks back at the cabin. Hands in his pockets, he faces the porch. Later, Zeb strides up to his sad-faced mother, bag in hand. He wears a straw hat, and the cuffs of his shirt stick out goofily from the sleeves of his tight coat. Eve stares off and gives a wince as Zeb kisses her cheek. She looks him over reluctantly, then straightens his string tie, pulls the flap out of his coat pocket, and brushes him off. Looking away briefly, she tugs on her apron. She reaches up, a black scarf dangling from her fingers, and gives his shoulder a tender squeeze. As Zeb heads down the dirt road away from the farm, a dog runs after him.
Go on back, dog! Go on!
Eve slowly approaches a family plot fenced off at the corner of the property. Four headstones stand inside. Holding on to the long black scarf, she kneels down in front of the rustic split rail fence. She gazes at two identical headstones that sit side by side in the tall grass.
What could I do, Paul?
He's Linus's boy. Always was more Linus's blood.
I guess that's why I love him so much. But you gotta help me pray, Paul. Help me pray.
Eve closes her eyes and slowly sinks down to the ground. She drops the scarf and hangs her arm on the middle rail of the fence. Now, Zeb strides down the shaded country road. Sunlight filters meagerly through the leafy trees above. The young man stops and looks back at his mother. He snatches off his hat and marches on. Night. On a battlefield near a river, soldiers run by with torches. Cannons lined up along the riverbank fire in succession, their plumes of blasting smoke billowing one next to the other. Two cavalry officers, dressed in blue, direct wagons past a country church. Nearby, soldiers dig a large grave for a dozen dead bodies.
Evening of April 6th, 1862. The guns that had roared all day fell silent around a little church called the Shiloh Meeting House. Many a man had met his God that Sunday, but not in church.
Inside a makeshift hospital, a doctor washes his hands as two soldiers lift a man onto a bloody table. The doctor checks for a pulse.
You wasted your time, man. He's dead.
But, Doc, this here's Captain Rollins. What?
Captain Linus Rollins.
Take him out.
Keep moving, men.
As the two soldiers carry off Linus's body on a stretcher, the doctor swigs from a bottle. A bearded officer bumps into one man who glares.
Why can't you look where you're going?
I'm sorry, soldier.
What?
A tall officer enters and stands by the bearded one. Both smoke cigars as they watch the doctor work on a patient.
Saw, brandy, chloroform. Get it all down here. Come on, all of it.
Come on, we're just in the way here.
The tall officer looks around, then follows his bearded colleague out.
It had been the bloodiest day of the war on the Western Front. In the morning, it had looked like a Confederate victory. But by nightfall, no man cared to use the words win or lose.
Eve's son, Zeb, staggers by.
After Shiloh, the South never smiled.
In his muddy blue uniform, Zeb drops on all fours by a stream. A trail of dried blood covers the side of his face. As he dips his cupped hand into the water and brings some up, a young man in rugged civilian clothes runs up from behind.
You tasted that water yet?
No.
We'll try it.
He thirstily scoops the water to his mouth, then spits it out.
Tastes funny, huh?
Yeah. I've seen it before sundown. It was pink. Pinker than sassafras tea.
You mean?
Don't seem fit in a man should have to drink water like that. Don't seem fit in a man should have to do any of the things we've done today. Did you kill anybody?
I don't think so. I got knocked dizzy right off. And when I come to, found my rifle, it was busted. And then some horse soldier come along and tried to stick me in the arm. All the rest is mixed up after that.
Well, I ain't killed nobody neither. And I don't want to. Hey, where you from?
Why?
This fool war started in the East. What's us Westerners doing in it?
I don't rightly know anymore. It ain't quite what I expected. There ain't much glory to looking at a man with his guts hanging out. Where are you from?
Texas.
Say, you ain't a Reb, are you?
Well, I was this morning. Tonight, I ain't so sure.
Seems like I ought to be shooting you.
Zeb grabs his broken rifle.
Well, you got anything to shoot with?
Zeb eyes the bayonet in his grip.
No. All I got is bayonet.
I got a pistol. I took it off a dead officer.
Grinning, he idly points it at Zeb, then tucks it away.
Hey, why don't we skedaddle out of here?
You mean dessert?
I mean, why don't we just leave this here water? The folks would want it.
Zeb stares off wearily.
They say there ain't no war out in California.
Get that battery over here!
A cavalry officer leads men to the riverside.
Banglers, join your regiment! Banglers, hey, you!
Zeb and the Confederate run away, crossing the bloody stream. Now, the two cigar-smoking officers confer. The tall one kicks down a broken fence rail.
Plan to move Russo's brigade into this area. Hidden battery. Placed well before dawn. You approve?
I'll approve any dispositions you want to make. If you hadn't held the flank today, we'd have been whipped for fair. Sherman, let's sit down a minute. Something I want to say to you.
The bearded officer walks away.
Landon!
Sherman follows. Now Zeb and the Confederate come to a clearing. Noticing the two officers, they duck down.
You may find yourself in command here.
Why?
I've seen some of the dispatches the newspaper correspondents have filed today.
Oh.
They're saying I was taken by surprise this morning.
You weren't taken by surprise. I was.
No matter. They're saying I was drunk again last night.
Were you?
No. But you can't fight front and rear. Win or lose tomorrow, I intend to resign.
Because of the newspapers.
The Confederate turns to go. Zeb pulls him back.
Because of a general lack of confidence in me.
Oh, don't you think I've ever felt like that? A month ago, they were saying I was crazy, insane. Now they're calling me a hero. But hero or crazy, I'm the same man. Doesn't matter what the people think. It's what you think, Grant.
The Confederate perks his head up.
You mean that's Grant?
I reckon.
General Grant.
You know this war is going to be won in the West. You know how to win it. Everything you've done proves it. And I say that a man has the right to resign only if he's wrong. Not if he's right. I guess I never thought of it that way. I'll think it over. What is there to think about? The Army's better off with you than without you. That's the test.
The Confederate slowly pulls out his pistol as he stares at the generals.
All right. Thanks.
Zeb notices him cocking the gun. As the man aims, Zeb pushes the Confederate's arm down.
What are you doing?
The generals turn to see Zeb stabbing the Confederate in the chest with his bayonet. As the Confederate stumbles and falls to the ground, two Union soldiers ride up. Zeb drops his weapon. He kneels by the slain man, grabs him by the shoulders, and shakes him.
Why did you make me do that?
He thrusts the man's lifeless body to the ground. Zeb slowly gets up and stumbles away. Now, on a daylit battlefield, smoke clears, revealing a distant Union regiment advancing up a hill. Explosions tear into the ground. Dirt and smoke blast upward amid the young soldiers. In a wooded glade nearby, mounted soldiers and supply wagons quickly cross a stream. The shallow water splashes wildly under their hoofs and wheels. As they reach the battlefield, one explosion severs a tandem carriage. Another sends a man and his horse crashing to the ground. Night. Dozens of cannons line the shore of a river. Men with torches line up behind and light them. Orange explosions dot the riverbank and send churning clouds of smoke out over the water. Daytime. A steamboat makes its way down a river. The steamboat pulls toward a dock at the river's edge, its gangplank raised into the air at the bow. Zeb runs up the gangplank before it's landed and jumps ashore. Reaching the dock, he waves, and the boat pulls away. Wearing his uniform and carrying a bedroll, Zeb runs off. Now, Zeb steps across a grassy field, his coat slung over his shoulder. He grins wistfully and takes a deep breath. His family's cabin sits before him, smoke billowing from the chimney. As he walks by the small family graveyard, he notices two new headstones. The raised ground in front of them is bare dirt. Slowly, he takes in the stone markers. One reads Linus Rawlings, the other Eve Prescott Rawlings. Zeb removes his hat and stares solemnly. He closes his eyes and frowns in the breeze. On the porch, Jeremiah empties a bucket of water onto the yard. As the family dog scampers down the steps, wagging its tail, Jeremiah drops the bucket and cups his hands around his mouth.
Hey, Zeb!
Jeremiah hops off the porch and the two brothers walk toward each other. Gaping, Jeremiah approaches Zeb and reaches out his hand to the bewildered veteran. Zeb slowly shakes it. Shifting on his feet, Zeb looks questioningly toward the headstones, then back at Jeremiah. Jeremiah shakes his head.
Didn't you give him a letter? I wrote more than 4 months ago. She never was quite the same after she got the news about Pa. I don't think she minded going, Zeb, except she wanted to see you again. Of course, Pa ain't really there. Put up a stone anyway.
Zeb looks to his brother, who stands, staring at the grave markers. Later, Zeb sits on the porch with the dog at his side. Jeremiah gives him a long-handled dipper, and Zeb sips from it. He hands it back to Jeremiah, then starts buttoning his vest.
Well, better be on my way.
Way? Where? I need you, Zeb.
Only one thing brought me back. She's...
Well, this farm is half yours.
I was thinking we could finally clear away that patch of woods down by the river and... You're twice the farmer I am. You don't need me. Farm's all yours. It's only fair.
Sure don't feel right about this. What are you gonna do?
I haven't mustered out yet. I can still transfer the regulars. Cavalry, maybe. Go west.
have to fight Indians? You sure are hard to make out, Zeb. Now, what do you want to do that for? Do you like fighting? You remember the story Pa used to tell us about fighting that grizzly bear?
Yeah?
And I asked him, I said, well, why'd you get in such a fix? Do you like fighting grizzlies? He said, well, not especially. I just wanted to go somewhere, and the bear was there first.
Jeremiah's smile fades as Zeb puts on his hat and collects his coat and bedroll.
I guess I just want to go somewhere, too.
Zeb stands. Jeremiah looks up to him and shakes his hand.
So long, Zeb.
Zeb heads off. As Jeremiah watches him go, he wrings his hands around the dipper. He bows his head and weeps into the back of his hand. Now a stagecoach crosses a wide open prairie.
Even while north and south were being torn apart, east and west had been drawn together by the Pony Express, the most daring mail route in history. 80 riders were in the saddle at all times, night and day, in all weather, half of them riding east, half riding west, between Missouri and Sacramento, carrying mail across country in days instead of months. Unarmed, they rode to save weight. $5 a letter the mail cost, and on thin paper, too. It was courage, skill, and speed against hostile Indians, bandits, hell, and occasional high water. Even as they rode, men were already building a faster message carrier across the country, the Overland Telegraph. And the Indians found a new amusement, listening to the level tune of the singing wires. But far less amusing to the Indians was the coming of the steel roadway of the Iron Horse. The surveyor's route lay through immense natural barriers, the Rocky Mountains, and the equally discouraging High Sierras. But range upon range could never stop the titanic contest between two corporate giants racing to put down the greatest mileage of track before they met. The Central Pacific eastward from Sacramento through the Sierras.
Men lay explosives on a snowy mountain.
And the Union Pacific, forging westward across the plains, with the Rockies still to come. The prize in the race was free land, vast parcels for every mile of track laid. Land that would one day be worth millions.
Now, two rows of men carry a pair of long rails and set them parallel on wooden ties.
All it! Set it down! Bikers, up!
A horseman arrives with two mules, each bearing an arrow-pierced corpse.
Where'd you find them?
About a mile back yonder. This is Johnny Horman.
This is Jack Perkin.
As workmen gather around, a man with a rolled paper approaches.
What the hell is this, a picnic?
Well, the Indians got a couple of our men and...
Mister, you were the foreman here. Now you're a track layer. Now get back to work, all of you. Move it! Fast!
He whaps one man.
You.
Yes, sir.
You're the new foreman till I can find somebody better.
Yes, sir.
Now get him at it!
Wait a minute.
The boss looks at the horseman.
Your name, Jethro Stewart?
He nods.
Well, Mr. Jethro Stewart, you're hired to hunt buffalo to feed these men, not to stop their work. Why'd you bring these bodies here?
The railroaders. I thought somebody in the railroad might be interesting.
I'm the railroad, and I'm not interested. You should have buried them where you found them, then tracked down the Indians who did it.
Well, Mr. King, like you said, I was hired to hunt, not dig graves or fight Indians. Those fellas are mostly old soldiers. You wouldn't think a couple of dead men bother them much.
Look, I don't want anything in their thick skulls but their work, you understand? Now get rid of those bodies. Start tracking those Indians.
You keep forgetting, Mr. King. My job's buffalo.
It was buffalo. Go to the paymaster and draw your time.
Well, now, that foreman fella, you didn't fire him. You just took him down a peg because you needed him. Who's going to shoot buffalo, you?
Now, in a smoky saloon, two women in pink leotards swing on a trapeze over a crowd of men. As they swing by, the men grab at them and pull them down. A plump barmaid tries to pull the men away from the showgirls. Meanwhile, in his uniform and hat, Zeb stands at the bar. He watches as four women dance onto a stage like a locomotive. Mr. King, the railroad boss, approaches Zeb and looks closely at his glass of white liquid.
What the devil is that?
Milk.
Milk? The army must have changed since I was in it.
Just rode in. I'm hungry.
Yeah, huh? But you'd rather watch them than eat. Is that it?
That's it.
Well, I wish you were as eager to protect this railroad. You get any word about those two men who were killed today?
I tracked the Arapahoes and talked to the chief. Those men were a mile off the right-of-way where they had no business, drunk and chasing squaws. It was as much their fault as it was the Indians.
Is that a fact? Well, soldier boy, your job is to fight Indians, not to agree with them.
Mr. King, there were 200 Arapahoes and I had 20 men. Now, to me, agreeing seemed wiser than fighting.
To you, you know, I might just send off a wire to the colonel. He may not agree.
Zeb shows King a paper.
I already reported. He does agree.
Daytime. The hunter, Jethro, hides behind an embankment, aiming a long rifle at a herd of buffalo. One buffalo goes down. As the rest run away, kicking up a storm of dust, a large group of Indians on horseback approaches Jethro. He greets the chief by raising his palm. Elsewhere, Zeb looks through a pair of binoculars.
Acknowledged and understood. Sergeant? Trouble, sir?
A soldier passes his hat back and forth in front of a mirror. A distant glimmer flashes in reply.
I don't know.
Hey, Lieutenant!
Jethro approaches on his horse.
I just got a message. The Indians are up to something. You know anything about it?
Chief says railroad busted the agreement. Changed their route. Coming smack through Arapaho hunting grounds.
You sure the chief's right?
Plenty sure. They're getting the war paint ready.
Now, Zeb stands in King's office.
Can you stand there and tell me that that one little change is going to cost the Arapahoes one buffalo? Or even one jackrabbit?
Mr. King...
They can be made to see it differently. Who's hurting them? What's a railroad anyway? Two tracks and a whistle.
It's not the tracks they're afraid of. It's what the tracks bring. The buffalo hunters slaughtering off their herds. And then the settlers coming in.
And when'll that be? 20, 30 years maybe? By then we'll all be dead. Right now we're just crossing the land, that's all. Land that's safe to the Arapahoes for our lifetime. Now, you go talk to them, smoke a peace pipe with them, do anything they want. Just get them to make a new agreement. That's your job, isn't it? Keeping the peace?
I'll keep the peace, Mr. King. But you keep your promise.
Zeb glares at him, then walks out. Later in the saloon, Jethro approaches Zeb, his long gray hair showing under his hat.
Here, your name's Rawlins. You're from Ohio. Your pa's name couldn't be Linus Rawlins, could it?
Could be.
Knew him. Jethro Stewart.
He used to speak of you.
Used to?
Pa was killed in Shiloh. Sit down, Mr. Stewart.
They sit at a table.
Well, better than dying behind the plow. I tried it. Settled down for a year once. Took 10 years off my life. Your ma. He must have been something real special, getting old Linus to stay put.
She was, Mr. Stewart. Very special.
Old Linus. 2 years running once, your pa and me trapped together, up along the Wanapee. Got ourselves so many beef, we had to tie him tail to tail just to drag him down the mountain. Over a mile long it was, that line of beaver pelts.
Mr. Stewart, my father could take the truth and stretch it about six ways. You sound just like him.
Zeb drinks beer.
I'll take it you meant that kindly.
Well, I'd think twice before I called you a liar.
Tell me something, talking about liars. Why would a son of old Linus get mixed up with a man like Mike King?
Well, I know what you mean. But Mike King isn't the railroad.
Oh? I don't think he knows that. changing the route back, is he?
No. I know. But he'd do anything to gain a day on the Central Pacific. He's not a fool. He doesn't want a war, and neither do the Arapahoes. I think I could get them to agree to this change in route if I just sit down and talk with them for a while.
Are you going to get them to do it?
That's just it. I need somebody that knows the language and who they trust. You wouldn't happen to know someone like that, would you, Mr. Stewart?
Zeb gives Jethro a sporting smile.
Your pa could set a trap like no man I ever come across. Just coax him on and wham.
Later, Jethro talks with the Indian chief while Zeb looks on. The rest of the Indians form a circle around the two men. Jethro goes to Zeb.
You better do something so you know you're pledging your word.
Zeb walks over to the chief, who sits cross-legged on the grass. He takes his pistol from its holster and empties the bullets out. As they fall to the ground in front of the chief, Zeb looks at him earnestly. The chief turns to a man behind him.
Break was it here?
The man hands the Indian chief an arrow, and he breaks it in half. He gives one half to Zeb. Zeb tucks the arrow under his arm and salutes the chief. Now, Jethro and Zeb ride their horses side by side across a prairie. They stop at the top of a hill and look down on the track layer's camp. A train moves along the rails below.
That blame whistles like the crack of doom for all that's natural.
Come off, elder man ought to make his scratch on the land. Leave it a little different than when he come. Anyway, thanks for fixing things with the chief.
Me, I fixed nothing. You put the words in my mouth, but that won't make him come true.
Jethro, I said what I had to keep the peace. I know there's a risk.
Risk? Maybe you don't understand. You pledged your word back there, not mine, not the armies, not the railroads. It was your word told them they'd keep their hunting grounds.
I think they will.
And I think you got your neck stuck out now like a prairie chicken waiting for one side or the other to chop it off. Your pa and me got kicked out of one territory after another with people pouring in, killing off game, putting up towns. It ain't gonna stop. Treaty's gonna get broken. I don't want to be around to see it happen. Look me up when you get your belly full.
Where are you going?
I'm heading back to mountains. A high lonesome, and ain't no people at all yet. So long.
Jethro gallops off. Now, on a snowy plain surrounded by mountains, men load logs onto a cart.
By now, the Central Pacific had broken through the wall of the High Sierras and was straining eastward across the flatlands of Nevada. While the Union Pacific, thanks to its long peace with the Indians, was able to keep up pressure just as avidly in the opposite direction.
Zeb leads his cavalry unit to the hill overlooking the track layer's camp. The clustered tents gleam dully in the sun beside the railroad tracks. As thick smoke trails from an arriving train, Zeb's unit rides downward.
The competition was exciting, but also costly, and both companies were itching to earn money from tracks already laid.
As immigrants step off the train, two women hang out of the windows and hug loved ones who greet them from the platform. A man with a rifle approaches a livestock car full of horses.
Did the horses ride all right, Jake?
No better than I did. We'll have to rest them a day before we can start hunting rabbits, much less buffalo.
An Indian in army uniform faces Zeb.
You say no buffalo hunter come. White man, liar, we scout for you no more.
The Indian rides away. Later, Zeb enters King's office.
Not in our lifetime, you said, and there they are, the buffalo slaughterers and the settlers.
All right, it's sooner than I figured. But the railroad's broke. They need money to keep moving on. No people, no money. No money, no railroad. It's as simple as that, Lieutenant.
And what about the Arapahoes?
Let's take a look at those people. Half of them straight from Europe. They'll have a rough time, but they'll make it. And you want to know why they'll make it? Because they're willing to change their ways. Well, the Arapahoes will have to change, too. If they don't, they're finished.
I know they have to change, and I know that someday the land will be taken over by these farmers with their towns and their cattle. But not like this. They don't have to be double-crossed, and I don't have to be a part of it.
You don't, Lieutenant? Well, aren't you forgetting that uniform?
That's right, Mr. King. I'm forgetting it. If the Army hasn't got any authority out here, I'm resigning, and now.
I don't see how that's going to help the Arapahoes.
Nothing will help them, but nothing's going to stop them.
Zeb storms out. Later, on his horse, he stops in a dry, grassy field. He rides on. Now, a dozen mounted Arapaho ride toward him. Zeb stops and raises his hand in a sign of peace. The Indian chief aims a long rifle at him. Unwounded, Zeb quickly rides off. Back at the camp, dozens of people stop and watch as Zeb gallops frantically down the hill.
We need a track! We need a track!
The immigrants and workers scatter as the Arapaho line the ridge overlooking the camp. Zeb rides up to King, who stands on a flatbed car.
Take a good look! You wanted a war, mister, and you got one. I hope you're the first man killed in it.
Turn those wagons over!
As King jumps off the train car, Zeb dismounts. Now, several men position themselves behind a tent and get ready to shoot their rifles. Others climb a wooden water tower. As women and children run to a shelter dug into the side of a hill, several men tip a wagon onto its side. King tosses Zeb a rifle.
Shoot to the lead horses. Try and pick off the chiefs.
Try that.
Zeb and King freeze, their gazes locked on the ridge. Hundreds of buffalo pour over the hill into the valley.
The Indians stampede the buffalo.
Dirty skunks.
Come on!
As King and Zeb run off, the dark mass streams downhill. The Indians ride behind the buffalo, scaring them forward. As more settlers flee to find shelter, King, Zeb, and a third man crawl onto the rails under a train. As the buffalo get closer, a pioneer woman and a girl run in their path. One trips and falls by the train tracks. As a soldier runs to their aid, the three are engulfed by the oncoming herd. Hundreds of the animals, larger than bulls, race through the camp, kicking up dust as they pass. Pointy horns curve up from their huge heads, and shaggy dark brown fur covers the front halves of their bodies. Three men hide behind a low pile of logs, but the stampeding herd tramples over, unhindered. The buffalo's legs kick up clumps of dirt as they tear through the camp. The onslaught parts around an overturned wagon, which tips back onto its wheels and crushes a man underneath it. A white tent gets swept up and thrust into a rickety shelter. Its supports give, and the ruined shelter is rammed along in the current of swift buffalo. Now, in a log bunker underground, men and women look around nervously as dirt rains down between the ceiling timbers. As the herd passes over, the ceiling collapses. The settlers disappear under the crumbling logs and dust. Zeb and King glance at each other. Atop the water tower, three men look down on the herd, which splits into two lines as it streams around a lean-to. A stray buffalo, blinded by a tense canvas, rams into the lean-to. The water tower gives a jerk, and the men on top keep still. Now, the Arapaho chase the last few buffalo through the destroyed camp. The dust settles, revealing several motionless bodies in flattened shelters. A fire burns beyond a tilting tree. Zeb walks toward the wreckage and looks around. His mouth agape, he watches the Indians ride back over the hill in victory. King faces him.
I told you there'd be no war. Look at them. They've quit.
They'll be back. They just sent a bunch of animals to kill an animal they call the Iron Horse.
Well, it's still standing, isn't it? And nothing's gonna stop it.
The two men watch as a two-year-old boy walks around aimlessly, sucking his thumb. He stops next to a woman's body lying on the ground.
You think you can live with that?
I can live with it or I can die with it.
Just listen. You can live with that?
That? That ain't crying. That's just new life going on.
King walks toward the camp as men and women emerge from hiding. A woman picks up the little boy and carries him away. As Zeb gets his horse, King faces the gathering men.
Rest of you back to work. We got a railroad to build.
From his saddle, Zeb watches King, who returns the stare, then walks away. Zeb rides off. The grassy plains stretch far ahead of him, meeting the vast blue sky. Now, King stands on the cowcatcher grill at the front of a slow-moving locomotive. He leans on a handrail with his back to the engine's dark iron boiler. An uneasy sneer forms on his lips under his tanned, squinting brow. Now, Zeb rides slowly down a dirt path, leading a pack mule. Snow-covered mountains sit on the horizon behind him. Later, on a mountain, Jethro scrapes fir pelts by a log cabin. Hearing an approaching horse, he grabs his rifle. Zeb rides up, smiling. Jethro puts down the gun.
Well, looks like you finally got your belly full.
Hello, Jethro. Appears you're doing well.
Can't complain. Crick's loaded with beavers, fighting their way into the trap. Ain't no white man looking over my shoulder, and the engines are plumb cordial. Toss your stuff in there. Plenty of room for two.
Thanks.
Nighttime, inside.
Bunking yonder. Better take your bearings now so as you can find it when you need it. If you don't like my snoring, you can build your own cabin tomorrow. I'll furnish the axe.
Zeb shakes his head.
Thanks, I'm just passing through.
Through to where? Anywhere you go is like where you've been. Ain't you lost enough tail feathers back there?
I've been plucked some. That's what I like about this country. There's always greener grass over the next hill.
Not no more, not since that damn railroad come. All the grass is being staked out now with a lock on it.
Maybe I'll just have to climb a little higher hill to find it. How about coming along?
You crazy? Like the engines say, these rocks and trees around here feel no call to move. Why should I?
Guess I'm not an Indian, Jethro. I'm sure not a rock nor a tree. Man belongs his own kind, like him or not.
Daytime. Zeb heads toward the snow-covered mountains. As he stops for a parting look at his friend, Jethro waves to him, and Zeb returns the gesture. Later, Zeb rides along a small rocky pass dotted with patches of snow. His horse's breath mists in the cold mountain air. Sitting tall in his saddle, Zeb stops and looks toward the distance with a wide grin. Now, cowboys herd hundreds of cattle across a grassy plain.
The coming of railroads brought changes in the land through which they passed. Now immense herds of cattle were driven hundreds of miles to meet the lines bound for markets in the east. Fences went up, cattle trails were barred, and a long and bloody wrangle began between cattlemen and homesteaders. The law was in the hands of whoever could shoot fast and straight, except where there was somebody determined to stand for law. Others might look on sheep and a shepherd as a pastoral scene.
A shepherd falls to the ground.
Not the cattleman. To him, sheep destroyed grass, and grass came dearer. And if a man's life were held cheaper than grass, it was considered a casualty of war, not a crime. And in all this, the man with the star was only one against many. But time was running out for the reckless ones, the desperados.
Zeb wears a marshal's star-shaped badge.
As more and more citizens demanded respect for the law and showed themselves ready to fight to uphold it, and the raw new towns that sprung up in the West began to dream of becoming as refined as that one-time hooligan city by the Golden Gate. San Francisco was now respectable. So sophisticated, in fact, it even had mansions up for auction.
Now, a couple enters an ornate brick mansion. Inside, a gray-haired Lilith sits within earshot of an auctioneer.
This trophy is solid gold and fully inscribed. Mr. Cleve Van Valen, President, San Francisco, Kansas City Railroad. It's a treasure he held dear to his heart. Do I hear $3,000 for this priceless possession?
Priceless, my foot.
Alone is worth
we used it for a doorstop.
$2,500.
$2,500.
A silver-haired gentleman next to Lilith watches the gavel go down.
It's a sad day, Lilith.
Sad? We made and spent 3 fortunes together. What's so sad about that? And if he'd lived a little longer, we would have made and spent another.
I beg your pardon, Mrs. Van Valen.
What?
The chair, it's been sold. I'm sorry.
Well, then take it. Quit apologizing and take it.
Thank you, ma'am.
There had been some other way to pay off the debts.
It doesn't matter. I've got 2 things no one can ever take from me.
A photo of Van Valen.
This and my land in Arizona.
Lilith, I don't want to dash any hopes. But that ranch is nearly worthless.
Well, it's there, isn't it?
Yes, but most of the cattle have been sold off or stolen.
I'll get cattle.
You'll need someone to work it, someone to manage it for you.
I'll get that, too.
Who?
My nephew. He's a marshal out there, somewhere.
Lilith, at your age, it might be kind of rough.
Rough? My ma and pa were killed going down the river just looking for land. I guess I got a little of that Prescott blood in me after all.
Later in the desert, a middle-aged Zeb drives a wagon carrying a woman and 3 children. Tall, eroded rock formations tower over them. He looks up at the high rocks.
I don't know, son. On our way home, you ask your Aunt Lilith. She'll tell you.
2 blonde-haired boys sit in the back of the carriage wearing cowboy hats. They look up at the surrounding terrain with interest. Zeb's wife smiles at him, holding a little girl on her lap. Tufts of grass dot the dry landscape. Later, the family passes an adobe hut as they cross the dusty red earth. Now, Zeb and his family wait on a station platform as a train approaches. His wife removes their daughter's bib as the little girl waves to the arriving train. Smiling, Zeb glances at them, his arms around his 2 sons. His gaze fixes on something nearby, and his smile fades. A dark-haired man with a ponytail grins deviously at Zeb, then beckons to a cohort who stares coldly down the length of the platform. Zeb stares back.
Honey? Do you think you'll know her?
What?
Your Aunt Lilith. Do you think you'll recognize her?
Sure.
Zeb? What's the matter?
Nothing. Come on.
Now, 3 rugged men watch Zeb. At the train's rear, a conductor helps Lilith step down.
Thank you.
Zeb's 2 young boys run up to her.
Ma'am, are you our great Aunt Lilith?
If you're Zeb's children, I am.
Zeb arrives with his wife and daughter.
Lilith.
Zeb. Zeb Rawlins. Goodness. I swore up and down I wasn't gonna cry.
You're just as pretty as Ma said you was. I'd like you to meet my wife, Julie.
Pleased to meet you.
I'm pleased to meet you, Julie. I just can't tell you how pleased.
This here's Eve, underneath all the jam.
Come on and meet Sam now.
Sam?
Sam's our horse. He could pull 2 wagons if he wanted.
Oh, well, if you'll excuse me, I have my orders to meet Sam.
Come on.
Oh, just a minute now, boys.
But he's on the other side.
Now,
come on.
Okay.
Come on.
Just a minute.
I think this means a whole lot to her.
You have no idea how much it means to me. To be able to settle down to a life of peace and quiet.
I'll get the luggage.
As he heads toward the train's far end, he sees the 3 shifty men greeting a 4th.
Jake!
Come on! The man has a large mustache and wears a cropped black jacket. As the others direct their attention toward Zeb, the newcomer does the same. He approaches Zeb and his wife.
Zeb, let's go.
Oh, Marsha!
Don't tell me you come all the way to Gold City just to meet me. I hardly expected it. And the beautiful Mrs. Rawlins? What a pleasure. I envy you, Marshall. A well-favored, bright-eyed wife. Just as dazzling as that sun up there. Makes you almost thankful, don't it? Makes a person want to live? Adios.
The man returns to his henchmen.
That's Charlie Gant. I thought you said he was in Montana. Zip.
I'm just going to get the luggage. That's all.
Now, the family's carriage pulls up in front of a hotel. Zeb pulls on the reins.
Stay to the rooms, will you, Julie? Prescott, take care of the horses.
Yes, sir.
Linus, help your mother.
Yes, sir.
Young Linus hops down from the carriage. His wife, Julie, watches worriedly as Zeb walks away.
Anything wrong, Julie?
No. No, nothing. Come on, Eve.
Julie lifts Eve from the carriage. Now Zeb strides along a planked walkway and enters a small office.
Hello? Zeb! Got a minute? Of course I got a minute.
The marshal leans on a desk and signs a piece of paper. Zeb looks around as the man opens a cigar box on the desk.
Cigar?
No, thanks.
Well, what can I do for you?
The marshal lights a cigar.
Good, name it.
I saw Gant get off the train this morning. There are three men waiting for him.
The marshal blows out his match and frowns thoughtfully.
That's why you're here, huh?
That's it?
Look, there ain't a thing we can do to keep Charlie Gant from going where he wants to in this territory.
Zeb glares.
I know. I know what he was. Well, that's over now. It was over the day his brother got... Should have killed them both that day, but... Well, you didn't. There ain't a thing I can do about it now.
What's he doing here, Lou? Ain't you even curious?
Well, now, what do you want me to do? Run him out of town at the point of a gun? You think we still put the law inside a holster here? Look over there.
He points to a courtroom.
There's the law. With all its writs and decrees and... We abide by that circuit judge now.
How many get killed meantime?
Nobody's got killed, nobody's going to. Doc Holliday, the Clantons, the Youngers. They're all gone now.
Charlie Gant ain't gone.
You get me a warrant, I'll get you Gant.
Lou, they want three guards in that wagon with the gold shipment tomorrow.
Three?
This is a big one. Over $100,000 worth. I'll take Clayton and Sims with me, all right?
The marshal, Lou, nods. Zeb stares as the man puffs on his cigar.
Well, what?
Doesn't that mean anything to you?
Well, it means we put on a three-man guard.
To the train. What happens then?
You know there's gold going out here every month or so. There hasn't been a train robbery since Jesse James was killed.
Zeb glares at Lou, then marches for the door.
Zeb. I don't want any trouble here now. We've been friends a long time. As a friend, I'd like you to leave town.
Zeb's stern gaze lingers, and he walks out of the marshal's office. Outside, Zeb's boys, Linus and Prescott, play near a mine. A pulley system carries large buckets up from a mine shaft and along wires that stretch high above the buildings. Leaning over a wooden railing, Linus and Prescott look down the shaft. Zeb runs over and pulls them back.
Boys, get back from there.
He picks up Linus.
Look down there, son. You know how deep that shaft is?
Uh-oh.
That's 1,000 foot deep. You know how deep 1,000 foot is?
Uh-oh.
Well, if you had 200 brothers all standing on your shoulders, you wouldn't be able to see over the top.
I'd be squished.
Come on.
Show you boys the donkey engine.
As Zeb puts Linus down, Gant and his henchmen ride up on horses. Gant dismounts.
You boys go ahead. I'll be along in a minute.
Gant approaches.
I hear you've been talking to the local marshal about me. Would you call that friendly?
I never considered us exactly friendly.
I don't like you, Marshal. I don't like what you and your kind are doing to this country. I don't want any trouble. You want to put things on the old basis? It's you and me? That's fine.
I'm not going to get in a fight with you, Gant.
Oh. It's peace you want, huh, Marshal? Peace?
There's only one kind I know of. That's the kind my brother's got.
What happened to your brother didn't teach you very much, did it?
Easy, Marshal.
Floyd never made mistakes, except the one time he trusted you. And you're the one that got away.
One of these days, I'm likely to pay you, Rawlins, as a little visit.
They stare at each other coldly. As Gant turns away, he points his fingers like guns at Linus and Prescott. The boys flinch, and Gant points at Zeb. Gant mounts his horse, and the four men ride off. Daytime. From the hotel's second-story veranda, Zeb watches men load boxes onto a wagon.
Get those gold boxes up there.
A lot of gold.
Come on, keep moving, boys.
Julie checks on him.
Zeb, Lou Ramsey's here.
They step into the hotel room.
Lou?
I warned you, Zeb.
What is it?
Gant came to see me last night. Said you tried to start some trouble with him.
You believe him?
I'm telling you, Zeb, you take your trouble to your own territory. I don't want any more of it here.
There won't be any more trouble, Lou. Gant's gone. He rode out of here early this morning.
With who?
His gang. They should be somewhere between here and Kingman, waiting on that train.
You don't fool me for a minute, Zeb. You're not looking for a robbery. You're looking for Gant. You still carry lead where he shot you. That was Texas. Then Oklahoma, where you killed Floyd. And now this. I'm sorry, Julie, but I don't want my office to be any part of this.
Lou storms out. Zeb bows his head, then faces the door to the veranda. Julie turns to him.
Zeb. Boys have got the team hitched.
I know.
It's almost time to go. Zeb.
He keeps his head low and stays close to the door, his hands in his pockets. Julie walks away from him and into the bedroom. She stands at the foot of the bed, rubbing a hand on her cheek. The door behind her frames her distant husband. Turning, Zeb follows after her and gently places his hand on her shoulder.
Julie.
No one's asking you to face Gant. No one's making you. We could ride out of here right now. We could forget it.
Lilith peers from a settee in the front room.
Maybe there's something you haven't told me. Is there, Zeb?
He shakes his head faintly. Julie lays her hands on his hips.
I'm asking you not to go. Please, don't go.
Sorry, Julie.
He steps out of her reach and takes his coat and hat off the bed. On his way out, he gets his holster off the bureau. As Julie wrings her hands, alone in the bedroom, Lilith rises to her feet and goes to her.
I guess there's nothing more pig-headed in a man than his sense of honor. They're all the same, every one of them. You take my cleave now. Never could turn down a poker game. Felt duty-bound to go. 3 nights running sometimes, but he wouldn't quit, not if his life depended on it.
Julie wipes tears from her cheeks.
I guess it isn't very funny.
Mom! Where's Pa?
Oh, that's where he is.
What's the matter with Mom?
Mom, now in the other room.
Lilith ushers the children out and closes the door.
What's the matter with Mama?
Nothing's the matter. You know any games?
We know tag,
musical chairs.
Tag.
I know hide and seek.
But do you know how to play poker?
Poker?
You're in luck. Sit down right there. Now, come on, sit down. That's it.
But we don't know how to play poker.
Well, it's time you learned. First, we'll start off with a little five-card stud.
Night. In a stable, Zeb stands by a carriage loading his rifle. A man's shadow appears on the wall. Zeb wheels around and cocks his rifle. It's Lou. Zeb relaxes as the marshal steps closer.
I'll take that rifle, Zeb. Your pistol, too.
Sorry, Lou. I just can't oblige.
Zeb continues loading his rifle. Lou takes a step back, unfastening his holster.
But the law wouldn't let you use that anymore.
I'll use it if I have to.
I'm going out of here, Lou, and I'm taking this with me.
To kill Gant.
That's what you think, isn't it? It's something personal between him and me. Well, Lou, it could be. If I settle down with my family and wait for him to come. And he'll come if I don't stop him here and now. I'm going to catch Gant red-handed, breaking the law. And then I'm going to use the law to put him away once and for all. The law, Lou. I'm going to use the law. But I haven't got much chance without your help.
Daytime. A train travels across the desert. Giant candelabra-shaped cacti grow amid the scrub by the tracks. At the front of the speeding train, the rails stretch across a narrow bridge over a ravine. Inside, Zeb strolls down the aisle of a passenger car. Reaching the front, he talks to a conductor.
How many men in the caboose?
Just one brakeman.
Is he armed?
No, never has been.
I'll be in the express car.
Zeb walks into a large car filled with crates and trunks. Lou sits on a box with a rifle on his lap.
Thanks.
Marshal, there's some riders up ahead.
A stocky rifleman alerts them.
I'll take a look.
As Zeb grabs his rifle, the marshal peers out a window. Zeb runs out of the express car and climbs a ladder on the coal-filled tender. Reaching the top rung, he spots a gang of 9 riders traveling at full gallop. Zeb climbs across the coal car, rifle in hand. Black smoke streams over his head as he peers down into the engine's cab.
Engineer, there's a barricade ahead! Open it up, wide open!
The engineer nods and accelerates the train. The locomotive's long shadow surges down the rails toward a pile of logs and rocks. Zeb crouches down, and the speeding train slams through. The debris scatters. Dust churns between the rails under the passing cars, which block out the sun. Zeb spots the 9 horsemen following the train. Now, Lou climbs the coal car ladder.
Zeb! Come on! Come on!
Behind the train, Gant and his henchmen catch up to the caboose. Gant lunges for the handrails and pulls himself aboard. As 2 henchmen make their approach, one checks the other. The rider and his horse roll down an embankment. Now, as the train rounds a bend, Gant and his men meet inside the caboose.
They all make it?
I don't think so. French's horse fell. I don't think he made it.
Well, let's move. It's a long way from here to that goal.
There's no danger. Just keep going.
Inside the passenger coach, Lou directs people out the front exit. Meanwhile, Gant and his men work their way over the long logs of a flat car. As the bandits file into the passenger coach, Zeb, Lou, and a third man shoot 3 of them. One wounded man looks up, clutching his gut.
Control us!
Gant retreats to the log car. As Zeb, Lou, and the third man advance to the open door, one of Gant's men fires, taking out a window beside them. Zeb shoots back, and the bandit rolls off the train. Meanwhile, under a rail car, Gant crawls along the bars of the undercarriage. Up above, 3 henchmen flee along the logs. Zeb fires. A chain securing the lumber snaps. The logs shift under the bandit's feet. As 2 bandits fall off, a third holds on, dropping to his stomach. Gant now pulls himself along the rail car's side. Back by Lou, Zeb steps up to the log pile. Another chain breaks. Zeb drops his rifle and grabs onto the swinging logs. The log with the bandit on it swings way out. Gant climbs onto an adjacent flat car loaded with machinery. As Lou continues shooting from the passenger car, Gant ducks behind a tractor. Now the man dangling from the log loses his grip. The pile shifts again. Zeb hangs from the underside of a log as it swings back and forth. Gant hides behind a boiler as Lou tries to pick him off from 2 rail cars up. The logs shift again. As Zeb hangs on, the coupler attaching the log car and the passenger coach separates. The 2 halves of the train pull apart. Lou watches as Zeb pulls himself to his feet on the flat car.
Back this train up! And fast!
As the three separated rail cars slow to a stop, Gant fires at Zeb. On the train's front half, the engineer pulls the brake lever and sparks fly from the wheels. Meanwhile, on the graded slope behind them, the separated cars start to roll backwards. Now, the locomotive stops and lurches rapidly into full reverse. As the separated cars speed downhill, Lou watches them close the distance between the two halves. Atop the caboose, one of Gant's men loads his rifle. Lou fires first. The man stumbles off and slams into a tall cactus, knocking it over. Aboard the runaway cars, Zeb holds onto the log pile. As the last two chains break, the cars coast over a bridge and the logs roll off the sides. Zeb still hangs on at the end of the flatbed. Now, Gant hides behind the tall boiler, exchanging gunfire with Lou. The marshal shoots the ropes that hold the machinery in place. As the mammoth boiler slides free, Gant falls on his back. Both the boiler and the tractor slide off the car and crash to the ground. As the lumber car passes by, a dangling chain catches on the tractor and drags it along. Zeb, holding on with one hand, pulls out a revolver with the other. He shoots Gant. The bandit aims his gun. Zeb shoots again. Gant stumbles. As he peels off a stray shot, the railroad track comes apart under the advancing wheels. Derailed, Gant's car snaps free of the others and crashes. Gant goes flying. The lumber car follows, angling down to a stop with Zeb still holding on. Now, the passenger coach rams past the tractor and derails. Narrowly missing Zeb, it veers into a cactus, and the train comes to a stop. Zeb scans the wreckage. As Lou and the rifleman step out of the passenger coach, Zeb climbs off the flatbed. Amid the dust and smoke, he stumbles wearily over to Gant's motionless body. Now, outside of the hotel, Zeb loads luggage onto a horse-drawn carriage. His family joins him, carrying more bags.
How come we're leaving so early, Pa?
We got a long way to go, son. Here.
He takes bags from Prescott as the family gets in the carriage.
Auntie, where are we going to your house?
Your daddy will decide that when we get to your home.
Annie, can we take Sam with us?
I think Sam is taking us.
Zeb flicks the reins, and a pair of horses pull the two-seater carriage out of town. Later, against a horizon of red mesas, the family rides in a sturdy wagon pulled by four horses. Bundles and crates fill the back. The wagon's steadily rolling wheels make long ruts in the smooth orange earth. Lilith sits in the back with the boys.
Pa, how much further is it to Antlow's ranch?
Well, son, it's around the next bend, and the valley beyond.
Oh. Mm-hmm. Antlow, do you know that song?
That's our song.
Your song? I sang that song long before your pa was ever born. Away, away, come away with me. Come on.
Where the grass grows wild, where the winds blow free. Away, away, Zip, come away with me. Where I'll build you a home in the meadow. Oh.
The family rolls on, panoramic views of the West appear. In the Grand Canyon, huge golden plateaus flank a deep valley. The broad waters of the Colorado River meander to the tremendous concrete face of the Hoover Dam.
The West that was won by its pioneers, settlers, adventurers is long gone now. Yet it is theirs forever. For they left tracks in history that will never be eroded by wind or rain, never plowed under by tractors, never buried in the compost of events. Out of the hard simplicity of their lives, out of their vitality, their hopes, and their sorrows, grew legends of courage and pride to inspire their children and their children's children. From soil enriched by their blood, Out of their fever to explore and build came lakes where once were burning deserts, came the goods of the earth, mines and wheat fields, orchards and great lumber mills, all the sinews of a growing country. Out of their rude settlements, their trading posts, came cities to rank among the great ones of the world. All the heritage of a people free to dream, free to act, free to mold their own destiny.
Now we soar high over a modern city. Large buildings line the edges of a wide freeway. Cars and buses drive on a crisscrossing interchange. From overhead, its curving roadways form shapes like a flower's petals. Now our view glides over a city on the water. A long suspension bridge stretches out over a bay to a small island. Gleaming buildings and tall skyscrapers cover the landscape. We sweep over a park, a Gothic bell tower, and the frame of a high-rise sheathed in scaffolding. Now we swoop toward the Golden Gate Bridge. Sunlight shimmers in a wide path across the water beneath it. Long suspension cables dip gracefully between two slender towers that rise from the bay. Our view soars across the smooth water and toward the distant horizon. Now, in a painting, riflemen and horses face a herd of buffalo. Yellow titles overlay the image, How the West Was Won, The End. Presented by Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer and Cinerama. Fade to black. Now, a photograph shows a stream that winds through a clearing to a forest of gold-leafed birch trees. A yellow title overlays the image. Exit music.
Everywhere and everybody is a millionaire.
It's so thick we'll get rich just picking up a chunk of things of bricks.
The stars, how bright they'll shine on that home we will build.